Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
My name is Carol Zachary, and these are my six words. Grandfather's poker gift, a hanging invitation.
Grandfather's poker gift, a hanging invitation, an invitation to a hanging, a small white envelope with a black border. Those six words are certainly an invitation to hear more about the story, so we're joined by NPR special correspondent Michelle Norris, who is the founder and curator of the Race Card Project. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be here, Steve.
Wow, profound start there. What's going on?
Well, a little bit about Carol. She now lives in Washington, D.C. She grew up in Idaho. She spent summers visiting her grandparents in Montana, a small town called White Sulphur Springs. And on one of those trips, she was put on punishment. In defiance, she had said no to her grandmother. She had sassed back. And her grandmother said, when the family goes out on a fishing trip, you have to stay home.
She left with my brother, and I was left with a grandfather who has emphysema, who can't really speak much anymore, in a dark, dank cabin for an afternoon. This man, who had no idea what to do with granddaughters, girls at all, finally said to me in this barely audible voice, "Go get a deck of cards." And what he taught me that afternoon was nine-card stud, a game with so much exposure that it would just make you sweat. And he never threw the game. And at the end of the afternoon, I won. I won my first game against my grandfather.
You hear her pride there. And her grandfather was proud of her, too. And to show his pride, he went and got that envelope.
It was a double envelope. And I started to open it up and read it. It was an invitation to a hanging that he had received in 1917. And attached to it were these three pictures of the men to be hanged. Well, I was a tomboy. I was curiosity with a capital C. I just started to pepper him with questions. Oh, Grandpa, you know, what was it like? Did they lose their heads? Did their eyes bug out? Did everybody cheer? Did everybody cry? And he raised a hand, which told me to shut up. And he said three words. It was awful.
That's all he said. But I'm like her. I have a million questions, including, tell me more about this invitation.
The invitation is formal. It looks like an invitation to a wedding or some sort of rather swank affair. And we know from our reporting that invitations to hangings in the early 20th century were fairly common. Hmm. And in fact, in Montana, they were required by law. And Carol Zachary's grandfather was a county auditor, so he by law would have been required to attend that hanging. And when we saw this invitation, when we visited Carol at her home, we sat outside on her patio, and she pulled out this big blue family album to show us that invitation that she received when she was just 9 years old. And she did a little show and tell.
I'm just taking the dust off my album.
It's this right here.
And this is the description.
Oh, the description of the, it says triple.
Well, it says triple hanging. It's an envelope that says on the outside, 1917, February 16th. And then the invitation itself, it's Mr., and then someone has written into it, Herbert Fleming. Your presence is requested at White Sulphur Springs, Montana, on the morning of Friday, February 16th, in the year of our Lord, 1917, to witness the execution of Henry Hall, Harrison Gibson, and Lester Fahley. And then the pictures. And it's RSVP.
Now, I just want to interject here. She mentions pictures, and I want to explain what she's actually describing. Our listeners can go to the website and see this as well. Steve, the invitation contained three wallet-sized black and white photos of the men she just named, Henry Hall, Leslie Fahley, and Harrison Gibson. They are black men, and each photo, as you see there, is marked with the man's nickname etched there on the photo. Henry Hall, for instance, has the name Bama etched on his photos. And the photos are curious. They don't look like mugshots.
No, they're dressed up. At least two of them, if not three, are wearing ties. They're wearing suit jackets. They're not looking at the camera, necessarily.
No, they look like professionally lit portraiture.
Yeah, like magazine photos, modern magazine photos. And these are the photos that are illustrating this invitation to a hanging. Now, I have to ask, these are African-American men. It's the early 20th century. It's a hanging. Was this a lynching?
We now know that it was not a lynching. Carol Zachary thought that, too. It was a legal hanging. These three men were arrested for a murder that took place in the commission of a robbery. Very little is known about these men. They were said to have been railroad workers. They were called hobos in some accounts, itinerant workers. And it was the first legal triple hanging in the state of Montana. It was a pretty big deal. It was a big news story across the country in 1917. There was some controversy around the execution. There was an effort to commute the sentence, but we came across a very thorough newspaper account in the Anaconda Standard, an article published in Butte, Montana on the day of the hanging, February 16th, 1917. And the article quoted then Montana Governor Samuel Stewart at length, and the governor himself said he was concerned that perhaps the race of these men may have been a factor, and he determined that it was not based on the evidence that was presented at trial. He denied clemency. The three men were hanged all at the same time on the morning of February 16th.
So you were able to find some of the story behind these six words in this invitation. What's still not known?
Well, it's not at all a case-closed issue for Carol Zachary. There's still a lot of mystery involving this, the mystery of those photos and why they looked like that, the mystery of why her grandfather gave her the envelope, and despite the fact that it was a legal hanging, said it was awful.
Yeah.
She wrestles with this, and she's careful to point out that she's not trying to say that this hanging was a mistake or some sort of miscarriage of justice, but she says it just feels incomplete to her. And Steve, when she first saw that envelope as a 9-year-old, she was fascinated by it. But now when she talks to us about the process of pulling out that envelope as an adult, she approaches it with something much closer to dread.
I couldn't believe what I saw. I remembered them as being very fierce, but as I laid them out there, they were three stunningly beautiful young black men.
She's whispering, so I want to be clear on what's happening there. She's apologizing. She's getting upset. She says the word stupid. It sounds to me, Michelle, that what she's saying is, I put these pictures away, and I changed the faces in my mind to make these young men more suitable to be hanged. And then I looked at the pictures again and realized my own bias, that I had changed my idea of who these young men were.
I don't want to read too much into that. When she was a child, she looked at them, and she was 9 years old, and they looked fierce to her. And now as an adult, someone who's lived a life, someone who has children herself, someone who has her own opinions about the death penalty, she looks at these pictures and she sees something else, and she wonders about the message in that gesture and the fact that her grandfather gave her the envelope. And one of the things she wonders is if he wanted her to understand that some things shouldn't make us feel good, that even if this was a legally sanctioned hanging, that in the end it's the taking of someone's life and some things shouldn't feel satisfying, even when they're dictated or sanctioned by law.
The cows. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Hi, Caitlin. Today's date, Thursday, April 28th, 2016, so I have been told. Fascinating segment a couple years ago on NPR. I was reminded of that segment as I read the book that we are going to discuss today. Try to cover as much material as possible. Learned a lot. Reading this book just reminded me again, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, reading is more important than watching television. It will come up during the course of the broadcast, but I would just ask listeners to kind of keep in mind some of the violence that's been happening at the Donald Trump rallies over the last few months or what have you, mostly black people being accosted. Even one of the images incidents, a white teen was accosted, and it was alleged that she was called a nigger lover. She was someone there who was protesting against Donald Trump, and she was pepper sprayed and allegedly called a nigger lover at the rally. But keep that in mind, as well as the film series The Purge. I think the third installment is supposed to be coming out this summer. We've talked about those films quite a bit over the past 2-3 years since the first one came out in 2013. And again, I would ask people to keep in mind Isabel Wilkerson, the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, a phenomenal essay that she wrote comparing lynching photographs to the deluge of dash cam footage, cell phone video of black people being killed. Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, insert, you know, whichever name, Sandra Bland, whichever name, whichever incident, you know, you would like to add to the list, but making a brilliant comparison, and I'll read some of those paragraphs from that brilliant essay a little later in the program. But just kind of have that in your mind as we move forward with the discussion. Our guest for today's broadcast wrote a really interesting book. I found it. It was in my Facebook timeline from some months back. The name of the book, Lynching and Spectacle, Witnessing Racial Violence in America from 1890 to 1940. And I think we've done a lot of programs here on lynching. There's much scholarship on lynching and what led to these crimes and the amount of times this sort of thing happened and what sort of things led to these incidents. I know we've talked about the importance of black journalists in covering this and working against these acts of white terrorism. Certainly the monumental work of Ida B. Wells Barnett. But her book focuses, I think, importantly, on the spectacle, the witnessing. When you see a lot of these images and you see throngs, sometimes thousands of white people have gathered to bear witness to these castrations, mutilations, hangings, slaughtering of black people and the significance and really dissecting what it means and why you have so many of these images of white people coming in large numbers to witness, and then the photographs and postcards. So even beyond the immediacy of the moment, you have this continual observation and witnessing of these incidents and what they mean. Very, very interesting book. I think reveals quite a bit about the system of racism, white supremacy. Our guest, as I said, she wrote this book. She is a historian at Illinois State University. Award-winning text, was nominated for the Los Angeles Times, one of their Book of the Year awards. Real privilege to have her on the program, joining us live from Illinois, our guest, Professor Amy Louise Wood. Professor Wood, you're with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
Outstanding. So glad to have you with us on the program. As I said, I want to try to cover as much as we can the time we have you for the program. Before we get started, anything that you think would be interesting or important for listeners to know about who you are and the work that you do?
Well, I think you covered it. You know, I started working on this book as a graduate student when I came across some photographs of lynching in the Georgia State Archives as a research assistant. And just, I had, you know, I was young and I had never had come across these kinds of images before and had, you know, I obviously knew about lynching, but the idea that people were photographing it, and that became kind of the seed of this project. You know, the book came out several years ago. I'm currently working on issues of crime and punishment and the sort of the idea of the criminal mind in the late 19th, early 20th century. So sort of taking my interest in crime and violence in another direction.
Fascinating. It would seem racism would probably pop up in that work as well, unless I'm
mistaken. Oh, yes. Yeah, unfortunately.
For listeners who have not seen, like, video or photos of you, you are a white woman. Is that correct?
Yes, I am.
Right on. This program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows. A global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
And I'm sorry, that's your definition of white supremacy?
And racism, and I use those two terms
and
as synonyms. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I mean, that seems, certainly it's global, I like the idea of system because then it also kind of covers both the ways in which there's a kind of intentional racism, which you get with that idea of dedication, but also the way in which racism kind of works structurally and systematically through our economic and social systems.
I know. I just like emphasizing in my definition, I do say system of people because I do think you're correct in what you just said in terms of how you have structures, laws, rules that govern how things are going to operate on this planet. But all of that is put in place by individuals who classify themselves as white in service
exactly.
to making sure the maintenance of white power. I just think that's very important because sometimes people say system and it gets divorced from actual white people. You cannot have a yep. system of white supremacy without white people, the actors in the
Absolutely.
System, making sure these laws are enforced, updated, revised, so on and so forth.
Absolutely.
Right on. Question I try to ask all our white guests we have on the program. There was an article that was published a little more than a year ago, about a year and a half ago, the end of 2014, and the author is a non-white author, but he was talking about racism, and he wrote a sentence. The sentence reads, "White people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough."
Mm-hmm.
The first portion of the sentence, before we get to the conjunction, white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism. Do you, as a white person, just your experience, your studies, your time that you've been around other white people, friends, family, so forth, the white people that you're around, do you think that they are sincerely and greatly pained by racism, like a significant, a sizable population of white people that you've come in contact with know of?
I think that's a really good question. I think that they are pained by it when they are made aware of it, but I think that most white people sort of put blinders on, don't want to be made aware of it, and certainly absolve themselves of that feeling, right, that they don't think of themselves as racist. And so when they encounter it as something that's kind of distant from themselves, and it pains them, but I like that second part, it pains them not enough. So I'm not quite sure, I mean, I think that that pain is sincere and it's genuine, but I think it's on some level superficial.
That's interesting. Very interesting. We've had been able to ask a sizable portion of whites at this point about that question, and I think a little more than half have had responses similar to what you said, and a little less than half have just said flat out that they think that is a false statement. And I say for our, I guess the major point I would take away would be when you said that you think sometimes white people have blinders on, so they're not aware of it. So when they are made to be aware of racism, then they might be pained at some superficial level, certainly not enough to solve the problem. That's
exactly.
one thing that I think is astronomically untrue. I do not think that white people have blinders. I don't think that they're unaware or ignorant. I probably would go through and cite your book to pick out some different passages to say that, in fact, white people cannot be ignorant, blinded, unaware, ill-informed about racism. As a white person, man, woman, child, you are expected to be informed about racism, whatever the era. And if you are ignorant about racism, other white people will let you know when you are making mistakes in what it is that you're doing. That's what I would say unequivocally. And in fact, I submit that I think that's one of the major reasons we haven't made more progress in solving this problem, thinking that somehow white people are not informed about racism. But some of this we'll discuss as we proceed with your book. Did you want to comment?
Let me think on that, because I think that certainly, I don't mean to say that they're not informed of racism, but I guess by blinders, there's a kind of, I would call it willful amnesia, right? Meaning that there's white people would prefer not to think about it. And so I don't mean that they're ignorant of it. It's that they're certainly aware. Although I'm not sure how much historically, I think there's kind of a willful, collective desire to kind of distance themselves from it and absolve themselves of responsibility for it. And I guess that's what I meant by blinders. And certainly, I guess, obviously there's, certain different communities, different groups within white communities that obviously there's some where racism is much, much more overt and present and celebrated. But I guess in the liberal enclaves that I live in, I think it's more this sense of willful amnesia.
Okay. I would only comment as moving forward, not wanting to be thought of as racist or not thinking of yourself as racist, that doesn't mean that you're not aware of, informed about racism. In my view, those are two very, very, very different things. With your book, and I guess for people who are following our book club or reading Harriet Washington's Medical Apartheid, she too begins with a quote from Richard Wright, although it's not this quote. But you start lynching and spectacle. You start off with first a quote from Jean Toomer and then just a profound quote from Richard Wright's Black Boy, 1937, where he writes, "The hostility of whites had become so deeply implanted in my mind and feelings that it had lost direct connection with the daily environment in which I lived, and my reactions to this hostility fed upon itself. Tension would set in at the mere mention of whites, and a vast complex of emotions involving the whole of my personality would be aroused. It was as though I was continuously reacting to the threat of some natural force whose hostile behavior could not be predicted. I had never in my life been abused by whites, but I had already become conditioned to their existence as though I had been the victim of 1,000 lynchings. The penalty of death awaited me if I made a false move, and I wondered if it was worthwhile to make any move at all. The things that influenced my conduct as a Negro did not have to happen to me directly. I needed but to hear of them to feel their full effects in the deepest layers of my consciousness. Indeed, the white brutality that I had not seen was a more effective control of my behavior than that which I knew. The actual experience would have let me see the realistic outlines of what was really happening, but as long as it remained something terrible and yet remote, something whose horror and blood might descend upon me at any moment, I was compelled to give my entire imagination over to it, an act which blocked the springs of thought and feeling in me, creating a sense of distance between me and the world in which I lived." If you're really attuned, you'll recognize the Ta-Nehisi Coates title at the end. Why did you start the book off with this quote?
I started off because I was interested in, lynching was a form of terrorism, right? And terrorism operates by its violence targeted against innocents, but then is meant to instill fear in other people who might be not know those particular innocents, right? That's how terrorism works, right? So I was interested in that idea of lynching as terrorism that puts, just the fear of it, not even having been seen it, keeps him in a state of fear, and has this profound psychological impact on him. But I was also interested in this idea where he says, I didn't need to see it for it to have meaning. And so I was interested in the idea that the way that lynching kind of operated, its power, its force, reverberated far beyond the actual event of violence, that it reverberated through the image of it, the representation of it. And then one of the arguments I make is that the spectacle of lynching were not just meant as messages to African Americans, but they were messages to other whites that were meant to fortify and reinforce white power and white supremacy for whites. And so I talk about how, for Richard Wright, he didn't need to see it for it to have that power. But for white people, the idea was that they did need to see it for it to operate ideologically to support their power, their authority. And that's what I felt like that quote kind of captured all of that.
I concur. I think image, when they say the cliche images are worth a thousand words, the image on the front of your book, and you have it again within the text where you explain more about it, lynching of Henry Campbell, a black male in Lawrenceville, Georgia in 1908. I mean, everything that Richard Wright captures in that quote, I feel when I look at that photograph, it is terrifying to see that, just this ocean of whites and this one single black person who is about to die be lynched in Georgia.
Yeah.
Is amazing.
Although that image is actually of an execution. So it's a legal execution versus a lynching, although I talk about the blurring between those two categories. He is about to die, and it is this kind of sea of white faces. Although there are some black people in the crowd, which is one distinction between a lynching and a public execution.
Do you, I guess you'll pardon me as a black person if I see little difference between an execution and a lynching in 1908 Georgia.
No, that's what I mean. They get blurred. Yeah, absolutely.
If you do make a point of making that distinction in the book, if you want to speak to that with our audience, execution, lynching differences.
The difference is that, one thing I argue is that lynching drew from the traditions of public execution. So if we want to sort of understand the rituals around lynching, we have to understand the lynchings around public executions. And, with an execution, you did have African American spectators coming to them because it was sort of a kind of cultural tradition, that executions were these kind of community events, and they were often events in which, and this is going to sound very strange to our 20th century or 21st century perspective, but they were events in which the condemned kind of had this starring role, that the condemned would come and there would be a sermon and the condemned would make a speech, and African Americans would come out to kind of watch that speech. You talked about in the invitation to a hanging that there were these three portraits of these black men, and the men who would be condemned to die in an execution would have their portraits taken. There was a kind of, the legal process offered them certain kinds of, certain kinds of dignity. And the lynching erased all that. It took the traditions of the public execution and essentially offered no sense of due process, no sense of dignity. And at that point, African Americans in no way would ever be in the lynching crowd. It would just be too terrifying. Their lives would be at risk. And so I do see some distinctions, although clearly the criminal justice system, was incredibly white supremacist. So I don't mean to say that there was, full due process rights for any black man in the Jim Crow South at all. But you do see these kind of slight differences there.
And you, I think in this book, really kind of analyze the significance, what is the meaning for these lynchings, and drawing on the history of having an audience for a legal execution, but then kind of unpacking what's happening when you have these throngs of people that come out to watch these lynchings, where it's, hey, we're going out to nab this black person or black persons, and, you know, they did something, or we think they did something, or whatever the case is, and they're going to die. And having these huge crowds, sometimes it being announced and paraded that this is going to happen at this time, and so you have these large numbers of white people coming out. This is on page, page two, where you write, even more, mobs performed lynchings as spectacles for other whites. The rituals, the tortures, and their subsequent representations imparted powerful messages to whites about their own supposed racial dominance and superiority. These spectacles produced and disseminated images of white power and black degradation, of white unity and black criminality that served to instill and perpetuate a sense of racial supremacy in their white spectators. Lynching thus succeeded in enacting and maintaining white domination not only because African Americans were its targets, but also because white Southerners were its spectators. If you can kind of unpack particularly that last sentence about these white people being spectators.
Yeah, I think so. One of the things that historians of the South have looked at is that white supremacy was not as stable a system in the late 19th century as it's often presumed, that there was, following Reconstruction, a lot of instability in the South. And, you know, African Americans were voting during Reconstruction. They were voting in the 1880s. And Jim Crow laws, there was segregation in schools, but Jim Crow laws weren't instituted until the 1890s. So there was a lot of kind of racial fluidity going on in the 1870s, 1880s. Not that this was a pleasant time, there was lots of violence, but there was, in particular, there was a kind of fear that lower class white, working class whites, poor whites, would band together with poor blacks over class lines, right? So a lot of elite middle class whites were kind of concerned about interracial kind of, you know, unionizing cooperative movements. And so white supremacy was something that kind of needed to be, it was an ideology that kind of needed to be reinforced. I talk about how it needed to be replenished. It constantly needed revisioning. I mean, whites were never really secure in their sense of power. If whites were secure in their sense of power, they wouldn't need to commit these acts of violence. They wouldn't need to codify segregation and discrimination into law the way that they did. I mean, it's actually a sign of this sense of white fear and anxiety about a kind of loss of power. So I talk about the way that, I mean, there's lots of ways that whites were kind of establishing their power in this period and trying to unify whites across class lines. Certainly Jim Crow segregation did that, disenfranchisement did that, but I talk about the ways that lynching did that and that the spectacles around lynching did that, and conveying messages to whites about black criminality, black degradation, and sort of in contrast, white unity, white superiority.
You just kind of giving context that you start to have a rise in these public lynchings of black people in kind of the post-Reconstruction period, 1870s, and moving forward. And this kind of coincides with, I guess, what we call urbanization, southern cities in particular. They're becoming a little bit more modern. They're growing. So this is kind of displacing the old kind of revered southern lifestyle and kind of having people in contact in different places. You have trains and this sort of thing that's kind of, as you said, kind of destabilizing the old way that things looked under white supremacy. Did you go ahead?
Yeah, you're having new, I mean, as you said, the railroads, that's where segregation first comes into being. I mean, in the rural South, you often didn't even have legalized segregation because the former slaveholders were the plantation owners and the former slaves were the sharecroppers. And there were these long traditions of sort of racial custom of this kind of paternalism. And it's as the South is modernizing and with new industries, with cities and towns, and suddenly, African Americans and whites are encountering each other in public spaces without that long tradition of this kind of hierarchical relationship in place. And that's creates a lot of anxiety and fears for whites, and they have to kind of find new ways to establish racial hierarchies.
Right. As I was reading your book, you talked about how in this environment, this increasingly industrial, and you're having railroads being built and telephones, electricity, and all of that, and you talked about how they would even lynch some of these black people from telephone poles. I was reminded of one of our previous guests, Yul Abyss, her book, Notes from No Man's Land, where she said she did not intend to write a book about racism. She was going to write about communication and the history of how telephones were built and that whole process. And she said in doing her research, she kept being sidetracked by all of these incidents of black people being lynched from telephone poles because apparently there were not trees close enough to get the job done. So they just used whatever they could find to improvise. You talk about some of the threats, even your book that you said you're working on now about criminality. This is on page 8, where you write, although not necessarily threatened economically by black men, many white middle-class townspeople did feel an intense personal and physical threat from them. They felt a keen investment in maintaining a strict racial hierarchy and ensuring that white male authority held sway in their communities. They were thus most likely to express outrage over moral decline and the spread of crime, which they perceived as direct assaults on their integrity, their honor, and their homes. Their fears about their own personal and social vulnerability ultimately led them to strike out viciously and excessively against the objects of their terror, which, of course, would be black people, correct?
Yes. And I find, you know, I think there's a lot of assumptions that it was really poor whites who were engaging in this lynching and these lynchings, and they were doing this out of kind of economic threat, labor competition from African Americans. And certainly there were a portion of lynchings that we have evidence that that happened. But when I actually started, you know, trying to find out who was in these mobs, and, you know, I would find sometimes members of the mob would be named, in newspapers they might be named, or sometimes you would have a local prosecuting attorney or a judge who would try to get indictments of the mob. And so, whenever I had access to the names of somebody in a mob, I tried to look them up in the census, and I kept coming across that these were urban people and that these were what I would call sort of skilled laborers, not unskilled laborers, or what I would call a kind of rising or striving middle class. They're kind of accountants and bookkeepers and managers. And these people wouldn't have been in economic competition with African Americans. African Americans would have been shut out completely from those kinds of jobs. So I try to think, you know, what are they fearing? And what they're talking about all the time is, you know, moral decline. There's, you know, cities are bringing dance halls and pool halls. I mean, these are very, you know, deeply evangelical Christian people. These are threatening kinds of institutions. And there's rising crime. There was rising crime amongst white people and amongst black people. It's rising crime, although that gets complicated because you start getting the kind of, I don't talk about it in my book, but you kind of get the creation of crimes, particularly to target black men, to fill the prisons with black men. So it all gets kind of socially constructed. But there's this, you know, there's this, they kind of tie together this fears of moral vice, moral decline associated with cities and with crime. And these are people who are just entering the middle class, right? They're not firmly established middle class. These are people in kind of flux and transition, and that's what I mean, where they don't feel that their authority is stable yet. And so they're the ones who are feeling sort of most threatened and vulnerable. And you get all these fears of crime that really just gets kind of projected onto African Americans. You know, if you read newspapers in this time period, it's just stories of crime after crime that led to this kind of hysteria amongst white people that their homes were under attack, that they were going to be personally assaulted. A lot of it is just, it's much more exaggerated than we actually know that crime rates were rising, but these fears can take on a life of their own, as we see.
Absolutely, absolutely. Just for listeners, number one, I think that is hugely important because I hear that a lot even today where people try to excuse or minimize acts of white terrorism and say, oh, these were just poor, down and out, no count white people. This is just white trash doing that. And that is just not true. A large contingent of all social classes of white people who are involved in these acts either directly or allowing them to happen. Hey, you know, it just had to happen. Yeah. Negroes are out of control. You just got to have these type of things to keep white power in place. That's one that should not be minimized at all. And then two, as you said about crime, I think if you look back at this time period, this hysteria about Negro hooliganism, this pushed a lot of the movement, particularly in the South, for prohibition, that we can't have all this wanton drinking because you'll have alcohol-crazed Negroes out assaulting white women. And this even gets pushed along with some of the drug laws that come into play, that we'll have crack-infused black people or weed-infused black people running wild and raping white women, that you see some of this in the early 20th century. And you write just kind of beautiful little paragraph here. This is page 13, kind of end of 13, going to 14. Mass lynchings emerged from this consciousness about the crowd and fears about social disorder, primarily in places on the cusp of urbanization, even as they encouraged and depended on throngs of spectators. Lynching spectacles, however, inverted and thereby diffused these fears. If urban life had threatened white authority by bringing whites and blacks together on streetcars, sidewalks, and markets, lynchings performed on city streets and courthouse squares reclaimed urban public spaces as decidedly white spaces. What is more, lynching spectacles reimagine the urban mob as an idealized community, a unified body of righteous and triumphant whites. They, in turn, isolated the figure of the black criminal, making him appear powerless and defenseless. Fantastic passage, and I hadn't really thought of these lynchings as we are reclaiming this as white space. We are in charge, and this is announcing it to everyone with what we're doing here, lynching this black person or persons.
Yeah, absolutely. And I talk about that in terms of the photographs, that the photographs create this image of the white mob as being orderly and righteous, right? That we associate the word mob with groups that are just out of control, unruliness, disorder. If you read the rhetoric of pro-lynching defenses, they never talk about the mob in this way. They want to see the mob as being orderly, as being in control. And I think the photographs do that as well. I think one thing I note is that the photographs, very rarely would a photograph show the lynching in action, the mob actually committing the violence. Now, part of that had to do with the sort of technology of cameras at the time, that you really couldn't show action. But even, shutter speeds were still, in the early 20th century, shutter speeds were much quicker, and we do have a few exceptions that kind of prove the rule. But instead, the crowd, we have evidence that, found evidence that the crowd actually stop their violence and then gather around their victim. And in doing that, they're not actually showing themselves committing tortures or violence. Instead, they're just projecting this image of this sort of righteous and orderly group, right, who are bringing law and order to the city streets.
Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest author and historian, Amy Louise Wood. This would be one when I would cite when people say that white people are ignorant or poorly informed or somehow lacking information about racism, white supremacy, right? This is on the bottom of 33. In its account of the public hanging of Will Mack, the Brandon News, Mississippi, reported that some ladies were present, as well as many little children. One mother kept her eyes on the gallows despite the nursing infant who tugged at her breast because she didn't want to lose any part of the program she had come miles to see to tell about to the neighbors at home who were unable to be at hand. To think about while awake, to doubtless see in horrible dreams when asleep, and to never want to see again. This image of the nursing mother pilgrimaging long distances to witness the death of a black criminal speaks particularly to the cultural importance of these events, which went far beyond mere morbid curiosity. For one, being present at the hanging gave one the authority to narrate the event to others, to tell about to the neighbors at home who were unable to be at hand. Astounding passage. Commentary?
One thing I try to do in this book is think about witnessing and what it means to be a witness, and how that relates to a sense how that ends up kind of supporting white supremacy or reinforcing white supremacy. And when we think about what it means to be a witness, we think about it both in the legal sense, where having watched something or seen something gives you a certain kind of legal authority, right? So you speak publicly about what you've seen in a courtroom, and your word carries a lot of cultural importance and weight, or legal importance and weight. And then we also think about witness in terms of, in evangelical Christianity, with sort of being a witness to, looking for witnesses to your salvation, right? So that someone who is has been saved will stand up as a witness to, as a kind of testifying to God's power. And again, there's a kind of public role that's played there that gives the person authority and importance. And both those understandings of witnessing would have been familiar to people in this time period, in the late 19th, early 20th century in the South. And so it's thinking about, you know, what did it mean for people to witness this event? And it would give people a sense of importance, of sort of, I've been there, I have seen this. And in having seen this, I'm connected to this social group. I have a public role. It connects me to my community. And there's a kind of a sense of authority that's given to you. And so I use that as an incident, that's a new, a lot of that. You were reading a quote from a newspaper talking about this woman being able to go and tell her neighbors about it. I talk about it in terms of the postcards of people who would, you know, witness a lynching and write, you know, buy a postcard of it and write on the postcard, I was there. That kind of authority was important in terms of creating the sense of white unity in a white community.
Absolutely. Which, again, I just submit, white people, you cannot be ignorant about this. You are expected to be a participant. You're expected to bear witness, to take part in this white authority, this white community, this white power. And coming to watch this, that is a form of your participation and being informed about what it means to be white and what you're supposed to think of in terms of, this is my perception of black people. This is how I should treat black people. All of that, I think, is wrapped up in the spectating, the witnessing, the sharing, the photos, everything. If you could comment, to me at least, there seems to be a strong element of necrophilia in all of this. And it's, to me, seems to be a running element of white culture, the system of white supremacy, and having some sort of really twisted pathological appreciation for black death, and being able to come and see the body, you even have many passages where sometimes if the lynching happened too quick, the whites would be furious that we didn't get an opportunity to see it. And then, of course, we're going to take souvenirs, we'll take a piece of the chain, or we'll take a piece of the body, or what have you. Just do you see that sort of thing as well?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, the selling of body parts, and yeah, as you said, this kind of anger when people felt that the lynching happened privately. So one thing I argue is that even sort of private lynchings that were committed by small posses, far out of town, become public through these forms of spectacle, through photographs, through the body parts. Sometimes a lynching might happen in the middle of the night by a small group, but then they would leave the body hanging for days for people to come and see it. And I think that gets to that idea of what I was talking about in terms of creating images of black degradation. So, you know, white people were fearing African-American power, right? And they interpreted African-American claims to their political rights and their civic rights. They interpreted those as Black people want to come and run us out of town, right? Black people want to come in and, you know, rape our women. They always interpreted Black, and this goes back to Reconstruction, Black claims for basic political and civil rights, they interpreted as assaults upon them personally. And that's why that, you know, you can't talk about the sort of the figure of the Black criminal without talking about issues of Black emancipation and Black liberation. They all kind of get wrapped up together. And so there's going to be a great deal of satisfaction to see the thing that you fear, the Black male body, and to see that in its most degraded state. There's going to be a sense of satisfaction and pleasure in that. And I think that's why they're taking the photographs of the bodies. That's why they're doing the bodies, the body parts of souvenirs and all of that.
Fascinating. I know on this program, we regularly, I insist that when we're talking about racism, white supremacy, that this is the religion of racism, white supremacy, because in my view, that's the way that it operates. And I mean, wow, you have many, many, if you can indulge me, I'm going to try to read like maybe three of these really quick before I get your comment on the role. And just it, really, in my view, this is not infusing Christianity. This is the religion of white supremacy. That's how we should think about this, even though it's borrowing some of the symbols that people would genuinely associate with Christianity and what have you. But you, this is on page 49. You write, bottom of 49, you write, they unleash the full force of their fury against these Black fiends through the blood rituals of lynching, rituals that created a veritable hell on earth. Lynching, in this sense, acted as more than a form of political terror that restored white dominance against the threat of Black equality. It became a divinely sanctioned retribution for Black sin, sin that threatened not only white authority, but white purity and virtue. These rituals also did more than simply punish the Black demon in their midst. Through their spectacular excess, they constructed a symbolic representation of white spiritual and moral superiority. Moving, this is on page 72, you write, religiosity allowed many white Protestants to anchor their own sense of moral integrity against this onslaught of modern temptations. That sense of moral integrity was often rooted in a nostalgic vision of a simple and virtuous past, what evangelicals deemed traditional values or old-time religion. Their nostalgia was manifestly tinged with white supremacy, especially evangelical churches played a significant role in the public commemoration of Confederate heroism and glorification of the lost cause in this period. Evangelicals likewise interpreted and celebrated in decidedly spiritual terms the political redemption of the Democratic Party, which restored white power after what were considered the gross injustices of Reconstruction. This is on 76, skipping down a little bit. The hyperbolic language was the same used to describe Black criminals, the demons and beasts who broke into homes to defile white women's purity. This rhetoric had particular resonance in the culture of Jim Crow segregation, a system arranged to keep white bodies pure and uncontaminated through the physical separation from Black bodies. In this scheme, the white body, especially the female body, was accorded an almost sacred status in its boundaries and borders, requiring protection against any violation. Pro-lynching reports thus regularly set frightening images of dissolute Black predators against the moral purity and Christian piety of their white victims. I will stop there. Just to me, this all seems very much the religion of white supremacy. Your comments?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, one thing I say in the book is that these were communities that were deeply steeped in Christianity, and I don't think there's any way that they could have sort of witnessed or perpetrated and then witnessed what they were doing without looking at it through Christian terms. And there's been a, you know, other scholars have, but other historians have looked at lynching as a crucifixion, and they've looked at African-American artists and writers who were interpreting lynchings as crucifixions. And so the lynching victim becomes kind of a Christ figure. And there have been other historians who've kind of talked about the ways in which white mobs were kind of scapegoating African-Americans and also kind of seeing it as a crucifixion within the scapegoat model. So one argument I make is that would be absurd, that there's no way that white Southerners would have been ever able to equate a lynching with a crucifixion, because they would not have been able to accord black men that kind of status being a Christ figure. Instead, I say that when you read their language, they use the language of revelations, that they feel that they are sort of God's messengers. They're kind of the angels of wrath coming down to punish sin. They're unleashing damnation and unleashing hell upon these sort of black fiends, black demons. They use these words like fiends and demons. And I tie that all into the stuff we were talking about earlier about the kind of fears of kind of moral decline that they see are happening in the communities around them. And all of that fears about moral decline and sin, their own sin, right, as they're, you know, they see their, you know, sons, daughters, family members, friends maybe engaging in what they consider sinful behaviors, all of that gets projected onto African Americans who come to represent sin and degradation for them.
Right. I just want to tease out, I'm making what I think is a distinct difference here, submitting that what's happening, these racists, these white supremacists, what they're doing, they are taking the Christian rhetoric or Christian symbolism and just applying it to their practice, their belief, their dedication to white supremacy, that is in fact the religion that's being practiced, even though they might be saying we are Christians. That's not what they're doing. They're practicing the religion of white supremacy. And just because you have so many great passages here that in my view just really make this very clear, this is on page 61. Where you write, in some extraordinary incidents, like the 1885 lynching of Harris Tunstall in Oxford, Mississippi, lynch mobs evoked religious rituals conspicuously, which lent the violence a more striking appearance of divine sanction. In 1897, a mob in Hawkesville, Kentucky, lynched Raymond Bushrod, a black man accused of raping and mutilating the daughter of a prominent planter, on a Sunday afternoon while a revival was taking place. The lynching took place in the courthouse yard, not at the revival, though, according to one report, the mob did its work in the broad opening glare of a Sunday sun and within a stone's throw of four churches. In recognition of the holy day, however, the infuriated mob paused so that Bushrod could confess his crimes and offer a long and fervent prayer on bended knee. And then just one more, just religion of white supremacy. You write one of my favorites, Birth of a Nation. You write, this is on page 153, Birth of a Nation does more than envision lynching as a legitimate exercise of secular power. However, it also sanctifies it through the use of Christian imagery. The Klan's leadership is endowed with religious authority, most conspicuously through the image of the burning cross, which first appears in the shot titled The Trial. With their white robes and crosses, the Klansmen in this scene resemble angels of judgment and death more than a secular judiciary. The film ends with the image of Christ projected over a jubilant crowd, representing, as the intertitle explains, the victory of peace and brotherly love over bestial war. That is the victory of white supremacy and the spiritual redemption of the nation. Any additional comments you want to get in?
I think you make a good point when you say that this is the religion of white supremacy. So they're using Christianity, right? Christianity becomes the tool in that sense. And you mentioned in that passage the 1885 lynching of Harris Tunstall in Oxford, Mississippi, which I think really kind of speaks to that. And that in that case, the lynch mob were, you know, ready to lynch Tunstall, but they recognized that it was a Sunday, and so they moved, they were about to lynch him in the courthouse, and they move him over and lynch him in a churchyard. And they kind of speaking to, I mean, in doing that, they're kind of recognizing, you know, what it means to lynch somebody on a Sunday, and then trying to kind of consecrate what they're doing by putting it in the shadow of the church in that way. And so I think that's a good example of what you were saying in terms of that Christianity then becomes a tool to consecrate white supremacy.
Right.
I can say more about Birth of a Nation if you like.
Oh, yeah. We're absolutely going to get to that. Just a few more things before I get to it, because I have a few comments on that as well. Just to add in, I also think it's this seems to be long running. This seems to be a core aspect of white supremacy, that we are not just doing this because we're depraved or this because we want to do this, that this is God ordained. This is manifest destiny,
yeah.
That God has said, the Bible has said that you're supposed to be slaves, that, you know, all of this there's a force beyond us that says you Negroes are supposed to be dominated by whites, like, eternally, forever. In fact, if you're not obedient to white power, you're sinning. You're violating God, you're violating religion and everything. You're a heathen of some sort. I thought you also made some really important points. We pay attention to words on the program, just the etymology of the word shot, how that relates both to firing a weapon, a gun, and to taking a picture, and just with regards to imagery and really, in my view, how that's just another form of the terrorism, the images and the photographs of all of this and the sharing. You write, this is on page 76, chapter of witnessing, you write, to take a picture of the victim in this state of debasement, reinforced this process by freezing the moment of representation in time. It created a fixed image of a united and orderly white citizenry in full mastery over supposedly savage and inhuman black men, an image that authenticated and reinforced the racist ideology that had justified and incited the violence. The subsequent public display and circulation of these kinds of images ensured that the lynching was visually remembered and repeatedly witnessed, that it was perpetually alive or in force. And then one more section that just kind of reinforces this notion. You write, while advertisements for cameras in southern towns sometimes made overt connections between photography and hunting, an advertisement for the Owl Drugstore in Hattiesburg, Mississippi read, "Do your spring hunting with an Eastman autographic Kodak. No game laws to conflict with this fascinating sport." Another in Waco, Texas, for a company that rented guns and Kodaks to the public, highlighted in large, bold type, "Go Kodaking, go hunting." These verbal associations between hunting and photographing only accentuate the ways in which picture taking at lynchings was itself an act of violence that reenacted the objectification and physical degradation of the black victim. In this context, the camera held and operated by white men shooting and capturing their subjects served as yet another weapon in what Susan Sontag has called sublimated murder. Your thoughts, Professor Wood?
One thing I do is I look at, if we try to understand the conventions of the photographs, if we look at these photographs and we try to understand why do you see the same kinds of conventions over and over and over again? You either see the shot of the African-American man hanging on his own, or you see the white crowd surrounding the corpse. And that is often one of the most prominent conventions that you see, the white crowd surrounding the black man's corpse as he's hanging. And as I said earlier, a lot of that is, they've stopped the action so that the white spectators and the mob could gather around. And I look at that convention in, you know, I actually have a hunting photograph in there that's where they're getting that convention from, right? Where you hang the deer that you've captured and you've shot and you gather around it. And it's a sign of your power over this beast of the animal that you've shot. And it's, you know, that's why do hunters do that? Why do hunters take pictures of themselves with their kill? They do it it's a sense of pride. It's a sense of celebration, and it's a sense of this mastery over nature that you're showing. And so I think the same thing's happening when you see the white crowd around the black man. It has that same kind of effect. And that gets to that idea that I was talking about before, where these kind of images of white power against black degradation, you're treating the black, I mean, what the lynching does, right, there's all this rhetoric of, you know, the black, they would call it the black beast rapist, right, that black men were bestial, that they're animalistic, and that's what makes them criminal, and that's why we're under threat from them. And the lynching literally, physically does that to black men. It takes that rhetoric of white supremacy and it literalizes it by turning them into the very beasts that their rhetoric imagines them to be. The act of lynching itself does that, the tortures do that, and then the taking of the photograph within those conventions does that.
Wow. When that's a powerful juxtaposition in the book where you have, I think it's like a deer that they've shot, yeah, and they're posed, and then they have, and it almost looks identical, except this time it's not a deer, it's a black person. Where it's
exactly
just that same mastery over the beast. In terms of this is the way that we view black people anyway. So, of course, it would be staged in a similar manner. But when I saw that, the first image that came to mind was Fred Hampton. People familiar, he was in the Black Panther Party in Chicago.
Yeah.
He was assassinated by Chicago Police Department in conjunction with the COINTELPRO program, J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI. And when they kill him, they take his body out and they take this black and white photograph in front of the house where they've raided in the middle of the night while he's asleep, killed him in his bed next to his pregnant wife. And it's posed in the exact same way where you have these enforcement officers and they're smiling. They got his body on the stretcher and it's just, we got him. Same thing if you can imagine if you've been out fishing or hunting and you've killed a lion. It's the exact same image with the body of Fred Hampton. And in my view, to convey the exact same point, this, you know, Negro beast, got him. White power over nature again. When you, and this is on page 81, just making the same point, this is the lynching of Claude Neal in Florida. We talked about this before on the program, yeah, with our guest in Florida in the book Beasts and Anti-Blackness, where just really great book talking about just racism isolated to Florida and this sort of thing happening. But you write, when the waiting crowd discovered that the mob had lynched Neal privately, they were reportedly outraged. The mob finally arrived with Neal's body in tow, and the crowd, which included Kennedy's family, this is the alleged white victim, took out their vengeance on the corpse, kicking and shooting it, tearing it apart, and even driving their cars over it. Neal's mutilated, nude body was then hanged on the courthouse lawn in the center of town, and hundreds of photographs were taken. The next day, as people congregated in the square to see the body, the photographs were sold to those purportedly still incensed that the posse who lynched Neal had denied them the satisfaction and pleasure of witnessing Neal's lynching. The images acted as visual replications of the actual spectacle, offering them vicarious access to the missed thrill of the lynching. The gratification local viewers derived from the images of Neal's lynched body was directly attached to their outrage over Kennedy's rape and murder, their fears of black criminality, and their desires to assert their racial power and superiority in the face of these threats. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, I'm trying to sort of make the point about the ways in which the photograph extends the viewership of a lynching across space and time, so that the lynching can just get witnessed again and again. That's one of the points I'm making there. I think the other point I'm making there I already made earlier in terms of this kind of sense of pleasure and satisfaction in the witnessing. But you see these, you know, photographs being dispersed, then, of course, the second part of the book argues that actually that dispersal ends up sort of helping the anti-lynching movement, and you get to this point where white Southerners suddenly don't want these lynchings, these lynching photographs and images out there. But initially, there's this sense of you can, this vicarious thrill that people can feel by looking at a photograph or watching a film.
Mm. Birth of a Nation is coming, folks. Speaking of film, this is a point I kind of wanted to flash forward, because as I read this, and even I think as when I emailed you to invite you to come on to discuss your book, when I see this, when I read about this, I view this on a continuum. I take the position that we're still in a system of white supremacy, and many of the ways of thinking, many of the behaviors that were acted out during this time period are still with us now. They've just been revised, mm-hmm. they've been refined, so they don't look exactly the same, but it's still the same underlying foundation that motivated a lot of what was happening then. And as I said, Isabel Wilkerson, I mentioned it at the top of the program, she wrote a just fascinating, just awesome. Number one, she wrote Warmth of Other Suns, which is phenomenal, top 10 book, outstanding read. We did it on the book club. You should definitely read it if you want a better understanding of mm-hmm. racism. But in addition to that, she wrote this article for The Guardian. It's titled, Mike Brown's Shooting and Jim Crow Lynchings Have Too Much in Common. It's Time for America to Own Up. And she's basically saying that these images that you see, as I've mentioned, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, you know, just insert whichever name, mm-hmm. Sandra Bland, that she sees just a really strong parallel to having all these images of brutality being meted out to black people, that it is eerily similar to what was happening and what you're talking about with Claude Neal and things happening at the beginning of the 20th century. Just quick paragraph from her. She says, lynchings were spectacles with hundreds, if not thousands, of witnesses and were often photographed extensively. Now, much of the recent police violence has been recorded as well. The chokehold killing of Eric Garner on Staten Island, New York, the beating of great-grandmother Marlene Pinnock on a Los Angeles freeway, and the gut-wrenching case of 17-year-old Victor Steen, tasered while riding his bicycle and then run over by the police officer in Pensacola, Florida, were all caught on videotape and have reached hundreds of thousands of watchers on YouTube, a form of public witness to brutality beyond anything possible in the age of lynching. And I guess just to add, I would insert, I remember in 2013, it was right after the Trayvon Martin murder trial, which was not on video, but when the trial happened, there was a release of photographs which had previously been sealed. So you got all these photographs of his corpse at the time of the shooting, Trayvon Martin. And I remember mm-hmm. on social media, these racist fiends, they had taken pictures of Trayvon Martin's dead body and they photoshopped his body in the shape of a swastika. That was one image. There was another image where they had taken his corpse and they turned it into a pinata, and they had George Zimmerman beating his body and Skittles falling out. And I mean, they were a litany. They were a litany. There were tons of them. I couldn't even share them because I knew some people would just be, you know, repulsed, and I didn't want to subject people. But I mean, there were tons of these that happened in 2013. I'm also reminded in 2014, because you did mention Eric Garner, there was when they decided that they were not going to indict Daniel Pantaleo. This is December 2014. They had a news report in New York that was kind of giving a live update because they had the protests and people marching and everything in New York. While they were doing this, they had two white people behind her. I don't think she knew they were there, but they were behind her. And they were like mockingly reenacting Eric Garner being choked to death. And so you can see the one white guy, he's choking his white friend and laughing, and the guy's going, oh, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And they just ha 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 and just go off laughing together. And that, when I see that, so I've seen this over and over. I think there was even a recent report where Donald Trump was kind of mocking this, where he was talking about one of his white colleagues and saying, oh, he can't breathe, he can't breathe. And people just kind of laughed at the rally, where it seems these same ideas of mocking black death and the witnessing the spectacle of having these images of black death that just can be passed around like baseball cards, postcards. It seems very, very similar 2016. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that's true. And, you know, I mean, the context in which these images are being taken is completely different. But you're right that you can see, you know, racists today using these images in very, very similar ways. I'm also reminded of with Michael Brown, that his body was left in the streets for, what, several days or at least a couple days? I don't remember how many, but I mean, way longer than, how many?
4.5 hours.
4.5 hours. Way too long, right? And reminding me of the ways in which the sort of the lynching victim's body had to be kind of left hanging. But it's also, I think, again, getting to this idea of the ways in which the images can then, you know, the meaning of the images and the meaning that's imposed on those images can shift over time. And that's what happens with these lynching photographs as the NAACP starts to, and the black press, like the Chicago Defender, starts to use these images to mobilize against lynching. And I think that, I mean, we're getting tremendous amounts of public attention to the problem of police brutality. I don't think necessarily, I mean, I don't know, but I don't think that there's, because the FBI hasn't really been able to track this really responsibly, that there's more police brutality now. I think we're aware of it because now we have police cameras and people have cell phone cameras and people are seeing these things. So there's much more, at least for whites, much more awareness of police brutality than we would have had 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So the images are kind of operating in more than one way, just as these lynching photographs operated in more than one way, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You talk about that recontextualization that happens. You talk about that kind of in the second half of the book, as you stated. I see, and even though you do have more of these images, so it can't be contested as easily to say, well, oh, you all are making this up about police brutality when you have all these images. Yeah. I see that same white supremacist idea of there really is not a lot of sympathy for black death. In fact, when you talk about these images kind of reinstill white power and black criminality, I see that play out over and over again. With Michael Brown, it wasn't, oh man, this black teenager, it was, he's a thug, he was committing a strong arm robbery, and he got what he deserved. With Eric Garner, he's a thug, he was selling cigarillos, and he got what he deserved. With Sandra Bland.
Or look what happened to Trayvon Martin, where, I mean, I think that first image of Trayvon Martin that came out, for me, the parallel was with Emmett Till, you know, where this image of kind of an innocent black boy who's, you know, gunned down unfairly. And then immediately the rhetoric on Trayvon Martin has to change, right, where he has to get depicted as this hoodie-wearing thug, right? So you're absolutely right on that. I totally agree. Mm-hmm.
Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Professor Amy Louise Wood. A couple of quick points. I do see we have callers. I want to nab them as well, see if they have anything that they want to get in. You talk about castration as well, which hugely important. That's something that we've discussed on the program repeatedly. I think you make a really interesting point in that a lot of these lynching photographs, you do not see black genitalia. Generally, that, even though this was a routine aspect of this ritual of white supremacy, white terrorism, the photographs you would see, they have pulled the black person's pants up or done something so where that's generally not in the images that we now see of these different lynchings that have occurred of black people. And you talk about how that would be almost too much. There's already so much hysteria about these Negro rapist and defiling the sacred white woman that you wouldn't want to put that in a photograph, even though certainly that's one of the things that happened routinely in lynchings. And I wanted to ask one of our guests that we've had on our program many, many times, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. She wrote the ISIS papers, and she submits that what she sees in these routine castrations, even Emmett Till was castrated, according to the reports that I've seen, that what she sees happening is that white people constitute a minority in terms of population on the planet, that they are less than one-tenth of the global population, and that they're really the threat that they perceive from black people is a threat of genetic annihilation, meaning if that there's too much sexual intercourse that you between a white person and a non-white person, you'll end up with people that look like President Obama, someone who is not white, and that you could end up not having white people on the planet if that happens too much, that white people have to maintain power in order to make sure that that does not happen. And that's why you have this constant fear that's even played out today, where you just had the governor in New England saying that you've got all these drug dealers that come up here named Smoothie and all this, and they get white women pregnant. Dylan Storm Ruth in South Carolina, same thing, before he goes on his white supremacist rampage, says, I've got to do this. You all are raping our women. I've got to do this. She says that what is underlying this constant focus on black genitalia and the castrations is this threat of white genetic annihilation. Does that make logical sense to you?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty overt in this late 19th, early 20th century period. They are talking pretty openly about their fears of miscegenation. And when they're talking about sort of the rape of white women leading to the loss of white purity, they're not just talking about sort of white purity, that the woman's virginity or her, you know, her purity would be defiled, but that would then lead to the defilement of the white race, that if there's too much race mixing, too much miscegenation, then we won't have we talked earlier about how they see this part of God's order and the natural order. It's going to be a breakdown of that natural order. So yeah, absolutely. That's the fear.
Wow. Then do you see this operating today still in either explicitly or implicitly motivating white supremacist behaviors, beliefs?
I'm sure it does. I'm sure it does overtly within, you know, white supremacist groups. Absolutely, they're going to still talk about white purity and in terms of sort of your average American, there I think that those kinds of feelings would be more subtle. I mean, we do know from polling that Americans are more, they're more tolerant of interracial marriage and that sort of thing. But I don't know. I mean, I have to kind of speculate, right? Because I don't have the hard evidence of the way you have the hard evidence in the early 20th century, where they're absolutely overtly saying this kind of stuff.
And you said average American, I would say average white person. For the average white person, do you think it might be evidence Donald Trump's popularity, since he's been talking explicitly about raping Mexicans, non-white people coming across the border?
Although I think I would say Donald Trump is very popular with the Republican Party, but if you look at his unfavorable ratings nationwide, most people are disgusted by his comments. Whereas I think, 100 years ago, his comments would have been par for the course, right? And no one would have blinked an eye at what he was saying. The other part of this, which I don't talk about in my book, but in the early 20th century, is the eugenics movement, where there was a real fear amongst white people that they were going to become a minority in the population, they were lumping in immigrant groups. This would have been sort of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants were worried about the fact that they were having lower birth rates and that African Americans, Italians, Polish were having large families, Hispanics were having large families, and that therefore there was going to be, that whites would soon become a minority in their own country. That language was very overt in the early 20th century, and I still think we have that language today, absolutely. We don't call it the eugenics movement anymore, but there's still this sense that a lot of white people express. And this is, I would say, when you talk about white supremacy, white being aware of it, I mean, there's definitely this feeling of, oh my gosh, we're not going to be the majority in our own country anymore. And they consider it their own country, right? And you see that, I mean, certainly that's behind Trump's success and all that.
Mm-hmm. I, uh, We have to, I guess when we get to November, we'll be able to see if that's if that is true, if Trump is really as poorly liked as people like to suggest, that he's just popular within the quote-unquote Republican Party. We will have to see when November comes.
Yeah, we'll have to. Hopefully. I mean, I hope. My God.
With Birth of a Nation, I'll touch this and then I'll nab some of the callers. This is these were two of the funnier quotes I saw in the whole book that I really appreciated, and particularly for the host, Gus T. Renegade. They were just fascinating. And this, again, goes to the point that you were talking about in terms of recontextualizing, taking something that was originally produced for one purpose, maybe in one setting, that can be removed from that setting and then repurposed, depending on who the person is that's doing the viewing, if we're talking about an image or a video, what have you. But you write, this is on page 172, in later showings of the film Birth of a Nation, some Southern blacks did become more demonstrative in their opposition to the film, creating the very scenes of racial discord that so frightened Southern whites. According to the Chicago Defender, a near riot was precipitated at a showing of the film in Salisbury, North Carolina in the 1920s when black spectators in the balcony applauded and cheered at what the white spectators deemed inappropriate moments. Although no violence broke out, whites in the audience threatened vociferous blacks that they would come up there and get you, to which some black spectators replied, "Come on up." Skipping down a little bit, black spectators like those in Salisbury who cheered at inappropriate moments were engaging in a rereading of the film that must have been startling to those whites who had accepted the film's white supremacist perspective without question. After all, those protesters who had sought to censor the film recognized its point of view even as they denounced it as false and damaging. But these African American spectators, though they too certainly understood the film's white supremacist perspective, disrupted that perspective by imposing their own reading on it through their cheers and hollers. According to a local patrolman, a riot nearly broke out at a 1931 showing of the film in Memphis, Tennessee, because the Negroes had been cheering every time a Negro killed a white man. Rather than boycotting the film, the spectators reinterpreted it as a picture of black revolt. Those were two of my favorite passages in the book. Can you talk about how D.W. Griffith's masterpiece, how this was kind of another aspect of white witnessing of white supremacy?
Yeah, so, I mean, I talk about the film, I mean, I talk about earlier lynching films that preceded Birth of a Nation, that kind of reimagined lynching on the screen, reimagining lynching on the film, and kind of allowed people, same as the photographs, kind of reenacting these stories of sort of white supremacy and white unity against the black criminal. And then I think Birth of a Nation becomes the kind of apotheosis of this. Right, it's this major masterpiece film. It's sort of been seen as the first feature film, and it was also a film that Griffith advertised and marketed as a respectable film. The film, when it started out, was seen as, you know, not a kind of shady entertainment practice. It was not necessarily a form of media that sort of middle class respectable people attended, but Griffith tried to change that. Griffith, along with other directors, were trying to change that and bring in more middle-class people and make film respectable. And so Birth of a Nation becomes this film that he's marketing as this respectable film, and it tells this story. It's basically just a pro-lynching, a defense of lynching. If you read sort of pro-lynching rhetoric and the propaganda supporting lynching, Birth of a Nation pretty much visualizes all of it and puts it on screen. And they talk about, you know, this was one of the things I'm talking about is how lynching becomes a kind of national practice through film, through the spectacle of it. Although there were lynchings across the country, most lynchings happened in the South, but, you know, in terms of the media of it becomes a national practice. And, you know, Birth of a Nation kind of epitomizes that. And then I also talk about how in the South, though, there was a kind of reverence for the film because Southerners felt that this film was, you know, was depicting their experience under Reconstruction and their experiences as victims of black emancipation. And the KKK comes in as kind of the triumphant heroes who are going to restore white power and restore law and order. But I also see the film as being this pivotal moment because it energizes the NAACP, and I also see this as kind of pivotal moment that the NAACP becomes kind of nationally known through their protests with the film that then kind of gives fire and fuel to the anti-lynching movement.
And have to pause just to make sure that I give credit. We really emphasize and talk about the monumental importance of black journalists down through the years, and you have a lot of that in this text. The Pittsburgh Courier and the Chicago Defender and the legend Ida B. Wells Barnett and NAACP, as you've mentioned, lots and lots of just phenomenal information in the book about their work and anti-lynching efforts throughout the 20th century. But just with this film, this will be my last question before I get to some of the callers. In my view, when I think of Birth of a Nation, which celebrated its 100-year anniversary last year, was much talked about in the midst of everything that's been happening, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Sandra Bland, blah, blah, blah. I do not view that film as an anomaly or anything to be ashamed about. I just I view it within the system, the religion of white supremacy. In my view, it would be an accurate statement that the culture of white entertainment, really the foundation of entertainment, certainly in this part of the world, the United States, is white supremacy. And I would just, if I would use Birth of a Nation as kind of a midpoint, if I was going to start, I would say, okay, let's go vaudeville, minstrel shows, you could put that as kind of the beginning, and the circus. I go back to one of our previous guests, Benjamin Reese, his book, The Showman and the Slave, Race, Death, and Memory, where he talks about how P.T. Barnum, where he literally bought a slave, gets this black female and takes her out on exhibit, and then when she dies, they have her body, Saint Necrophilia, they have her body and have people come and pay money to come see her corpse. So put that kind of at the beginning, Birth of a Nation midpoint, and then I would go right now. I could pick anything, but I'm just going to pick The Purge because I think that's a really significant film for many, many, many reasons. Franchise, not even one film. I picked The Purge just because the first film that came out, The Purge 2013, it came out the same summer as the Trayvon Martin murder trial. The premise of this film is that sometime in the future, I think it's set in like the year 2020, I could be a year off, but it's sometime in the future, things have gotten so bad in this area of the world that they have decided, they have made it a law that it will be legal one day a year, any crime. So if you want to kill people, rape, whatever you want to do for this one period of time is fine. No prosecutions, no penalty, do whatever you want. And then you have to wait another year before you can do this again. It's called The Purge. The crux of this film, a white mob is chasing a black male to kill him. And he runs, and a white family gives him sanctuary. And they don't even mean to give him sanctuary. It's kind of accidentally he gets sanctuary, and then they have to decide, are they going to hand him over to the white mob? This film comes out the summer of 2013 in the middle of the Trayvon Martin trial. This film, I think the budget was less than $5 million, and it made something ridiculous like $65 million. People going to see this film where a white mob is hunting a black male to kill him. They make a second film, which is basically the same premise. This time it's a black two black females, where this band of whites is going around in a van killing people, and they're trying to kill this black female, two black females. They have a third one that's election year that's coming. I would just submit that's the foundation. That's the totality of entertainment, certainly cinema, really entertainment period, is racism, white supremacy, killing, brutalizing black people. Is that an accurate statement?
I think if you look at the history of entertainment in this country, you can't think otherwise. I mean, look, the first mass entertainment in this country was blackface minstrelsy, beginning in the 1830s with the minstrel troupes. And then, as you said, it's the circus, and moving on to the ways in which minstrelsy then comes into vaudeville, and the ways that minstrelsy comes into film. One of the interesting things, if you look at sort of the three landmark films of the early 20th century, Birth of a Nation, even before that, the first sound film is The Jazz Singer, which has Al Jolson in Blackface Minstrelsy. It's about race. And then the first Technicolor film, Gone with the Wind. So you look at sort of the three kind of landmark films that sort of develop the technology of film, and all of them are films about whiteness and white supremacy. It's just woven into the fabric of our entertainment.
We will nab our callers. Folks have questions for Professor Amy Louise Wood. Feel free to chime in. The number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Our caller in Canada, did you have a question for Professor Wood? You should be with us.
Okay, I have... Hello?
Yes, sir.
I have three questions. First...
Okay.
First question. What is, in your opinion, the relevance of class as to how whites view black people? This can be now or back then. Time period open.
So the relevance of class to how white people view black people. Back then, I feel more comfortable as a historian talking about that period because I have more sound evidence to go on. But as I was saying earlier, you know, we tend to dismiss racism as a kind of sort of poor white phenomenon, that they were felt threatened by African Americans for economic reasons. And, you know, what we found is that that's not true, that lynching was perpetrated by people of all classes. And I see it in particularly this kind of striving middle class group being at the heart of it. But certainly lynching would not have been able to have gone on so long if it didn't have the approval of elite whites, sort of the professional middle classes who held the power in these places. Although you do see, you know, what you see as lynching starts to decline or sort of becomes less spectacular, more hidden, is that you see elite whites turning against lynching, largely because they recognize that there's kind of been this national shift in opinion and there's this kind of national embarrassment about it. In terms of more broadly than, and so they're worried about their bottom line, right? They're worried about losing northern investment, northern capital, that kind of thing. In terms of your question, in terms of how whites perceive African Americans, I do think it crosses class lines, but you are, you know, what you see in the South amongst with elite whites is this kind of older, what we call paternalism, where they kind of have this sense that they're going to take care of African Americans, and that is very much a kind of elite sensibility. So you do see some kind of class differences in terms of sort of strains of racism. I don't know if that answers your question, but... Hello?
Okay, that was clear. Thank you.
Okay.
Now, for my second question, how, in your... Because I mentioned you... I realize you brought up interracial marriage. How, in your view, does the tolerance of interracial marriage show less racism or... run contrary to the fear of genetic annihilation, in your opinion?
So how does the tolerance of interracial marriage show less racism? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, and the second part of it is, how does it show that whites do not fear genetic annihilation?
Largely because if you look historically and you see these very overt fears of interracial marriage, and we see a shift. I mean, just the fact that it's no longer illegal, right? Interracial marriage used to be illegal up until 1967. So clearly there's more tolerance for it. At least legally, there's more tolerance for it. And so I think that there are whites today who still hold those fears of losing white purity. Certainly, you know, we still have the Ku Klux Klan. They're going to believe that kind of thing. I think the acceptance of interracial marriage and acceptance of mixed race children, I think on its face is a sign that that people are less worried about kind of that notion of racial purity. I don't know if I'm fully answering your question, but that tolerance of interracial marriage is kind of pretty clearly shows that that fears of loss of racial annihilation, that's more muted, right? That we don't, it's not as dominant in our discourse as it was 100 years ago.
Okay, so, well, your answer was clear. I disagree, but your answer was clear.
Okay, now, well, how do you disagree?
Well, I disagree because, well, in the Latin, or I guess the Spanish-speaking parts of the Americas, they did use miscegenation as a way to weed out the black people. And
okay,
I don't see interracial dating absolves a person from being racist, considering that there were...
I would agree with you there. I absolutely do not think that interracial dating absolves someone of racism. But that's a different thing than sort of fear of racial annihilation. I see those as. No, I don't think I would disagree with you on that. And certainly if you look at, you're right, in terms of, in terms of the English colonies, right? In terms of most of North America, there was this kind of one drop rule, where if you had sort of one drop of African blood, that you were considered black, and you did not get any kind of status of whiteness. But we see in other cultures, Spanish culture, French culture, where there was we could call it maybe more tolerance of miscegenation. That all still happened within a very, very strict hierarchy, right? So you've got, people of, they would start mulattoes, quadroons, octoroons, and the more white blood you had, the more status you got. So certainly you're absolutely right that in other cultures, you could have a system where there would be more tolerance of miscegenation within a system of white supremacy and racial hierarchy. I absolutely agree with that.
Okay, so now for my third question. I don't know if Gus asked you this at the beginning of the show because I missed part of the beginning, but are all white people racist? Why or why not?
Are all white people racist? Yeah, this Gus asked me this in the very beginning of the show, and I really can't answer that. I mean, I'm a historian, so I'm not a sociologist, and I don't. I certainly believe that we have structural racism in this country. I would not deny that for a second. But I think that racism is, it's a complex pattern of thought. And I don't think I could make a blanket statement saying that all white people are racist. I think that all white people benefit from racism, and I think that all white people benefit from the history of white supremacy in this country, and all white people benefit from structural racism. That statement I'm comfortable making.
I appreciate that caller in Canada. Thomas in New York. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for our guest, Professor Woods? You should be with us. Thomason? Mm-hmm. Oh, could you speak up? We're having a tough time hearing you. Your volume is kind of low. If you could speak up, sir.
Hello?
Go ahead. Let me see if we can hear you. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. Are you there, Thomas, in New York?
Can I be heard?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm having some phone difficulties. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers. Good evening to the guests. Thank you for coming on this evening. I have three quick questions. This one is very fast. I just wanted a number. What percentage of the white households in America today do you think would pay a pay-per-view to see a lynching of a black person?
What percentage of white households today would pay-per-view to see a lynching? I have no idea.
Can you take an educated guess? Just the number. I think it's in the high 90s. So
You think it would be in the high 90s?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. There's been some discussion. What if we televised executions? Would people watch? And regardless of, regardless of the
race. You're talking specifically about a lynching of a black person.
Yeah.
I mean, we could pick one, O.J. Simpson, let's just say. What percentage of white households in America do you think would pay to see that? Of course not yours.
You say 90%. I have no idea. I'm not even comfortable hazarding a guess on that because it would just be pure speculation, and there's no way to sort of get an empirical understanding of that. If you say a majority, I wouldn't be surprised. I talk about this in the book. There's lots of people who are coming to witness these lynchings, and we don't know always why they're witnessing it. There have been oral histories done of people who came out to watch these lynchings, and they'd always say, "Oh, well, I just went because I was kind of curious." Hello?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Hello?
We can hear you. We can hear you.
Okay.
I think he's
I'm here. I'm listening.
Okay, so they'd come out and they would say in these oral histories, I just came out to be curious. Now, they could be completely lying, right, because they're never going to tell someone who's interviewing them why they're actually there at the lynching. But what I argue is that in some level it doesn't matter why people are coming to watch this lynching. There may be people out there who are saying, oh, I'm just there. I'm not there because I agree with this. I'm just there because I'm kind of curious. But even their presence there ends up creating this crowd that gives them credence to what's happening, right? So even if you disagree with something and you watch it, you're giving credence to it. You're making it legitimate. You're making it socially acceptable by creating this crowd. I can see a similar thing happening if you talk about today with pay-per-view, where there would be people who would watch it because they were sickened and they were disgusted by it, but they're still going to watch it. But even then watching it, they're giving credence and legitimacy to it. But I would have no idea what percentage of the population.
That's a perfect segue to my next question. The white people who refer to themselves today as Jews, they've been indicting and imprisoning and capturing Nazis since World War II. Do you think that blacks should use these pictures of lynchings to pursue justice? Are the white people in the crowds who are active and willing participants, some of them even paid to participate?
I'm sorry. So should African Americans seek justice by persecuting or prosecuting the people who were involved in lynchings? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I would imagine that everyone in the picture is a participant in that lynching. And I just said, some of them even paid to watch it. So I think that a few of those people are still alive today. And I would just want to know if you think it would be a good idea. I mean, the Jews are still pursuing Nazis today for crimes that happened in the 1940s and 30s.
Yeah, I think there actually has been talk of this, being able to prosecute the people in the crowd because it would be very difficult to track those people down. As I said, I've been able to sometimes find names of people who are indicted, but, we only know a small portion of the names of people who are in these crowds. But there have been, there's two things I'll say. There have been cases where they're going back from the 1960s and prosecuting people who were involved in civil rights murders and bombings because they know those names, members of the Ku Klux Klan, and there's no statute of limitations on that. So you do see that, what was his name? Beckwith, who the murder of Medgar Evers, for instance, was in Mississippi, was tried and convicted, 10 years ago, many, many years after his crime. But there has been talk of not prosecution, but some sort of reckoning in particular communities. Waco, Texas is doing this. I think Rosewood, Florida. in Duluth, Minnesota, that had lynched three black men. It's a northern lynching. And there's been various attempts.
Reckoning? What's reckoning?
Well, sort of similar to what happened in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to sort of for whites to redress what happened under apartheid. So similar kinds of things like that happening at a local level where you bring the white community together and the black community together, where whites, by reckoning, I mean an addressing, right, where they come to acknowledge these past crimes. There's an apology and a kind of how do we commemorate this? How do we, through art, through public art, through memorials, how do we commemorate and memorialize the victims of lynching? The idea is eventually a reconciliation between the white community and the black community. So there have been attempts to do this, but not specifically like prosecuting individuals. I think largely just because the practicalities of that would be very difficult. And many of these people are dead. Most lynchings happened in the late 19th, very early 20th century.
Okay, I mean, I don't think if that happened to white people, they'll just take reckoning. Do you think it'll be a good idea to take the pictures of the lynchings? And this is my last question. Thank you, Gus. Take the pictures of the lynchings. There's several, I'm sure thousands of them, if we could find them, and make billboards out of them and place them throughout the black areas around the country. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
So take them and put them in billboards in African American communities?
That would be a great reminder of what happened for black people who seem to have forgotten, and also to see the large amount of crowds gathered around the body, smiling, posing as the bodies hung there. I think that would be a great
I think putting them on billboards, we're still talking about, one of the disgusting things about these photographs isn't just the crowds, but it's taking somebody at their most private moment, the moment of their death, right, and it's exploiting it. So I would be uncomfortable just for the dignity and the memory of those lynching victims to sort of blow up their pictures and put them on billboards.
Every year they show videos of the Jews from concentrations on television. And they show
the
bodies and everything. So I don't think that's a good argument.
Well, it's the billboard part of it, because what is happening are these photographs. Now, there aren't thousands of these photographs, so we only have a collection of maybe a couple hundred. But what they are doing is putting them in museums for public viewings, and not blowing them up, but, you know, keeping them in their actual, you know, historic preservation of the size of them. And there have been exhibits in Atlanta, exhibits in New York, exhibits in Pittsburgh, exhibits in Chicago. They're kind of going around the country. There's a website that you can go to. If you go to withoutsanctuary.org, it's a website that shows these photographs. So there is this sense of, if we can show these photographs, we can kind of keep the memories of this going, and so that both, you know, African Americans and white people retain the memories of this. And I was involved in the exhibition of these photographs in Atlanta back in 2002, where we had a lot of public forums in both white neighborhoods and in African American neighborhoods, talking about where should these photographs be shown and what context should be shown, who will come and see these photographs. So, I mean, you raise an important point. My only thing would be the billboards would make me uncomfortable, but I absolutely believe that these photographs need to be shown as far and wide as possible. And I encourage you to go look at the website.
Roz, if you had a question for Professor Wood, you should be with us. I actually saw the Without Sanctuary exhibit, James Allen.
Oh.
I saw that in Atlanta, no less. I think I saw the one that you participated in at the King Center.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Roz, did you have a question?
Yes. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to you, Professor Wood, and to all of the callers. I had a couple of questions. I just wanted to say in relation to that that comment you just made, I just think for the way that black men are shown being shot to death on TV on a regular basis, and some people have really big screen TVs that would be the equivalent of a billboard, and they're watching this repeatedly, it's the same thing. So I agree with Thomas. I don't have a problem with it simply because we're watching this stuff, you know, in a video format, but it's the same thing every day. And
that's a good point.
Like Gus brought up earlier, you have, you know, white people making jokes about black death. So to me, I think it should be for everyone to see, just so that we understand what we're dealing with on a daily basis. But just to get to the questions, thank you for taking my questions. You said earlier that blacks asserting their power, I would say, let's say, attempting to vote, things of that nature, made whites feel that blacks would basically oppress white people the way white people oppress blacks, and they would react by lynching. And I wanted to ask, would you say that any form of black autonomy, because essentially white people controlled black people's lives in all areas of people activity back then as they still do today, would you say that any form of black autonomy was considered an act of war based on the fact that white people's reaction was to just go out on these wholesale lynching parties anytime black people tried to assert themselves in any way or fashion or free themselves in any way?
I mean, certainly black autonomy was deeply threatening. Absolutely. I mean, black landowners, black shopkeepers, black businessmen, black professionals had to be very careful and were very wary. I mean, it was dangerous. But it's often a little bit more complicated than that, because it wasn't as if any person, you know, black landownership numbers were increasing in this time period. So it's not that sort of anybody, any black person who gained any kind of autonomy was immediately lynched or killed. I mean, most lynching victims were accused of a crime. That doesn't mean they committed the crime. Oftentimes they would sort of, you know, grab someone off the street and you know, they would make that person, if they were looking for a suspect, they didn't often care about due process. They didn't care about whether that person that they pulled off was actually the suspect. But it was always framed within this kind of fear of crime. And so I think there was a kind of psychological transference or projection that was going on there. So it's not that sort of every black person who became autonomous became a target of lynching. It's that the general fears about sort of gaining, you know, increase in black autonomy, increase in black liberation, created all sorts of fears that got transferred into fears about crime and fears about assaults upon white people. And then you get this kind of backlash with lynching. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Yeah, it does, because it sounds like you're saying essentially they felt any black autonomy was a threat to white supremacy itself. So in other words, they still had to be in charge regardless of what was going on, and any form of upward mobility was a threat to that. So again, it kind of leads to that white supremacy being the motivating factor. But I wanted to ask, and this is bringing up kind of what was talked about a little bit earlier. I was going to say, would you say that lynchings were the equivalent to the Roman Colosseum of its day in terms of the spectacle, simply because they didn't have TV back then, so this was a form of entertainment? Whites killed black people for fun, the way that the Roman Colosseum functioned in a similar manner. And how does that relate to the murder videos that we're subjected to on a regular basis on the news, and how that plays out in the psyche of the public as far as black people and white people?
I mean, you said it right. I don't know if there's a question there, but I mean, I think that it's more complicated than it was simply entertainment, right? Because I think that on the one hand, yes, they're turning these into photographs, and they're turning into these postcards, and there's souvenirs, and then there's lynching films, so it can look like it's all just a party. And you hear them talking about, you know, barbecue, and they'll use those languages to talk about a lynching. But on the other hand, if you read their rhetoric and how they're describing a lynching, they also saw them as deadly serious. I mean, they really saw these as they saw this as a form of crime control and therefore a form of racial control and keeping the racial order. So the kind of the entertainment gets gets kind of mixed in or merged with or blurred with something that they actually took very, very seriously at the same time. And in terms of the present day murders, again, I would say that those murders take on, those images take on very, very different meanings depending on their context. So for some people, they're entertainment. For other people, they're something to mobilize around, and they're something that's terribly, terribly serious.
All right. Thank you so much for your answer. My final question is, would you say that the repeated viewing of Black death has traumatized Black people collectively in the form of post-traumatic stress and anesthetized white America and reduced the value of Black life? The reason I ask is because when the video of Rodney King surfaced, there was basically it was the first time that anyone was able to see what Black people have been saying for decades was happening to us at the hands of police. And nowadays, to see Black death as an everyday event, and not saying that there isn't rioting, there has been, of course, Ferguson is a great recent example of that, but there are others. But for the most part, this happens on an almost daily basis with no visible reaction like that, visceral reaction like that. And it does happen in certain instances, but it's not as regular occurrence as I would say it should be. Would you say that that's kind of proof of that?
Well, okay, so the first part in terms of sort of the Black trauma, I don't feel qualified to talk about that in present. I don't think as a white person it would be even kind of appropriate for me to talk about that. But one reason, and Gus began with the quotes by Richard Wright, one reason I just love Richard Wright's writing so much is that he writes so eloquently about the psychological impact of white supremacy on his life and on his psyche. And I think there have been writers since then, going from, you know, James Baldwin to Nnedi Coates, that can also really speak eloquently to that much more than I ever could. To your other question about the desensitization, I think it's a really interesting issue. And it's one that scholars who work on visual culture and photography, that we think and talk a lot about. What is it, what happens when we're just exposed to images over and over and over again, and how does that desensitize us to those images? I think certainly in terms of lynching photographs, desensitization that was happening there. But I think you make a really good point about when you said that the Rodney King video came out, and I would say the same thing with the Eric Garner and the Tamir Rice, that you said that white people expressed a lot of shock, and you said, but Black people said, well, this is what's been happening to us for years. You're seeing what's been happening to us. And I think I think that's so true. I think that these events aren't new. It's just that they had gone hidden for many years. So I talk about in my book about how lynching, that you get this shift to what's called hidden violence in the 1940s and 1950s. There's still violence against African Americans, but it's not, there's no photographs, it's not a spectacle anymore. Whites are kind of, they don't want these images circulating. And so I think many whites could kind of become distant from it. They could believe that these things aren't happening, and that those videos have kind of shocked white Americans to sort of, you know, I think Gus was saying it earlier that they could, you know, white Americans could say, oh, well, the guy probably deserved it, or they hear about police brutality, but they don't quite believe it. And then they see those images and it's shocking. But then you raise this other issue of if we're just seeing them, are we going to reach a point where these images are coming out more and more, where suddenly white Americans do get desensitized again, right? Where they just kind of go, oh, well, there's nothing we can do. There's another image. There's nothing I can do, and just kind of, you know, sit back and again, as I was saying in the beginning of the program, have that kind of willful amnesia about it. So I think, I think you make a good point about that.
One on one. Carl, I think this is Topelo. Did you have a question for Professor Wood? You should be with us.
Greetings to everyone.
Greetings.
I have a question. I haven't really heard the answer to this by any of the historians, so I'm going to ask this question and two more if I can. Where does the idea of white or the classification, the status, what it is, where does that idea come from in the United States of America?
Where does the idea of white come from? It's a really interesting question because who got defined as white changes over time. Generally, you don't hear, if you read documents from, say, the 16th, 17th century, they're not using the category of white. They're not talking about whiteness so much. They're talking about Europeans. So there would be Europeans, and then there would be Africans, and then there would be Indians. And you start seeing, through like the 19th century, this understanding of, whiteness. But even then, there would be groups that we now would consider white who would not be considered white. So white in the 19th century largely referred to Northern Europeans, people of English descent, German descent, and Scandinavian descent. Irish people, for instance, were not considered white. They were often depicted seen as more similar to African Americans. And then if you get, the late 19th century where you see a lot of Italian immigrants coming over, they would have been seen as a separate race. Jews, when they were starting to come over in larger numbers, were seen as a separate race. And a lot of historians have kind of written...
Let me interrupt you for a second because the idea of white is also the definition, within the definition of the word citizen in any law book. So... this was thought of when they were writing down this independence, or should I say the Constitution. So I want to know, where did the idea come from? Because obviously they had it in their mind when they wrote the Constitution. The status was in place. Where does the idea come from for them to instill it within the Constitution and to keep...
So what do you mean, where that there's whiteness in the... Are you talking about the Three-Fifths Clause in the Constitution?
No, I am talking about the word and the status of white. Where did it come from? Who brought it in? And how did it manifest into to what it is within the Constitution, within the system that's running this country? Europe who were not considered white, coming from Europe who were not considered white, all of a sudden had the idea that they were white. I want to know, what's the catalyst that thought this up and put this in place? How did they do it?
I don't know if I can answer that because it's something that happens kind of culturally. Certainly... as I said, it sort of began with the sense of European superiority.
Superiority over who?
Over people of African descent and people of Native American descent and people of Asian descent.
We're talking about the 1700s.
The 1600s, they're largely talking in terms, they're not talking in terms of race necessarily, they're talking in terms of peoples, and then in the 18th century, you get the rise of scientific racism, where they start trying to classify groups, so that's where you get the word Caucasian, and they would say people from, these northern European countries share certain physical characteristics, which they would attach to certain intelligence and certain moral characteristics, and then they would have they have these elaborate charts in the 18th century of African peoples have these physical characteristics and these moral traits, and you know, Asians have these characteristics and these moral traits. So you get the beginnings of scientific racism in the 18th century that's supporting white supremacy. I'm not sure if that's what you're looking for, but that's where you get...
Not really, but okay. So let's just say it just appeared out of nowhere. How did they put it together to where it come, where the unity, where does the unity of this whiteness come from?
Where white people start identifying themselves as seeing themselves as a social group that's united?
Where they needed to, where they felt that they needed to identify themselves as white so that they can do all these things like start hanging people from trees.
Well, that, you know, again, that's part of that same process, right? That people, as soon as you get this kind of hierarchy where the people of European descent are seen as having power and are seen as having, being citizens and having more rights, then certainly that's going to want people to be associated with that group, right? So you're going to get that sense of, and it's, you know, it works in terms of social class, right? A lot of people looked at the ways in which this served the interest of elites, of people who, you know, have people who have political power and economic power. If they can create this sense of white unity and allow poor whites to feel that they are more aligned with the wealthy rich guy than maybe an African American person who you know, has more in common with economically, right? So they want to keep poor whites and poor blacks from uniting together against the rich planter, right? Against the rich plantation owner. That plantation owner needs to kind of foment racism, fuel racism amongst poor whites to kind of keep that unity, that white unity, so that whites see themselves as having more in common with each other than they do racially, than they might economically.
Okay, now my last question. Now we just walked right into my last question.
Okay.
This rich racist oligarchy.
Yeah.
That's what I've heard. Yes, it is. Rich racist oligarchy. We who studied the history know that the oligarchy didn't give a crap about any of these white people that were poor.
Yeah.
And they pretty much showed it. So I want to know, what was their reason to support the white, poor whites, against the productive blacks? These racist oligarchy. What is their reason to support the poor whites? These people that they were given white status to, what was their reason to support them?
They need them
over
they
the productive
them.
Blacks.
You could look at it different ways. One, their own racism kind of takes over, so they're gonna start seeing whites as more deserving. But you could also look at it in kind of economic terms, that they need poor whites' support. I mean, if you look at, say, slavery, right, and you look at the Civil War couldn't have been fought if poor whites hadn't supported the institution of slavery. If poor whites had rebelled against the institution of slavery, then the Confederacy wouldn't have been able to, they would have fallen immediately, right? So,
we saw the riots in New York. We saw the riots in New York, specifically, when we studied the riots of New York, and it just doesn't add up. When you study how the migration, the great migration of the black people that come up from the South to go into Detroit, I mean, Ford built cities for black people to stay because they couldn't go into Detroit or live in Detroit. That just doesn't add up to any kind of support. And all that was just to undermine the so-called white unions that started up immediately after slavery ended. So it doesn't look like these oligarchy is really supporting whites and trying to undermine every move every 5 minutes. I'm wondering what in the world, where does these so-called poor whites get in supporting the oligarchy and the oligarchy claiming to support them. Where is that at?
No, you're right in the sense that they're not giving poor whites much, right? They're keeping whites underfoot. What you see them doing is, in their rhetoric, in their discourse, is for any resentment or frustration that poor whites might feel against the oligarchy, against the people who have power, the people who have money, all of that ends up getting transferred onto African Americans, right? So when, you know, with the black migration, with the race riots in the 1940s in Detroit or in Chicago in 1919, where you see poor whites or white working class people who are facing an economic recession, like in 1919 with Red Summer, right? They're facing an economic recession after World War One. They're feeling incredible amounts of economic frustration. They don't go and burn down the rich white guy's house, right? They don't go down and burn down the oligarchy. They go into the black neighborhoods and burn down the black neighborhoods. Now, you can talk, there's complex reasons why that's happening. You could just say, well, they've been hoodwinked, right, by the oligarchy to sort of transfer any of their rage or any of their economic frustration onto African American people. I mean, look at nativism now with the anti-immigrant sentiment, right, where the immigrants become sort of, they're seen as the problem for working class whites, rather than it's the corporations that are the problem. It's a long-standing problem in this country, or long-standing dynamic in this country.
Caller in Virginia, did you have a question for Professor Wood? You should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Greetings to everyone on the line. Ms. Wood, earlier when you and Gus were discussing the recent videotape or recording of Black Death, you made the statement that the context with which these images are being received has changed. What exactly is that change in context?
I think there's different contexts in which these can be perceived, but I think it gets back to what I was saying earlier in terms of that these images, many of these images are coming from either people, observers on cell phones who are, recording this, and they're recording it to kind of keep a surveillance on the police, right? They're not recording it as kind of celebration of what's happening to Eric Garner. They're recording it because they want it, a documentation of what's happening. Or they're coming from police cameras where the police are, the police aren't recording this because they want to celebrate this. The police are recording this because they've been required to have police cameras. And I'm sure many of these police, as we know of what happened in Chicago, where they're trying to suppress these videos, they don't want these videos out. So in that sense, the context in which these are being produced is very, very different from the photographs that were produced in the reasons why these lynching photographs were produced. And the lynching photographs were produced by photographers who were sympathetic with the lynching crowd and who were, these were supposed to be souvenirs of the lynching. So that's what I meant in terms of the context in which they are produced are very, very different. The context in which they watched, that context can shift. There might be people who are watching it because they get satisfaction in seeing another black person shot, or there's people who are watching it because they want to protest this, they want to mobilize around it. So there's a difference between how the context in which something's produced and the context in which something's witnessed.
Okay, and my last question is, I believe it was Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. who stated that the purpose in studying history is to learn from history and the mistakes that were made so that they are not repeated again. Take the good and put them to use. As you have stated, you are a historian. So what have you learned in your studies of history that will help in ending the system of white supremacy and replacing it with the system of justice? What solutions or at least steps to a solution have you developed in that
Well, I would say a couple things. In terms of lessons we can learn from history, I think that the lesson that we can learn from the history of lynching, in terms of sort of how do we stop this kind of violence, is the power of activism and the power of mobilization. I think the Black Press and the NAACP were very successful in their claims. They didn't end racism, they didn't end white supremacy, but because of their actions, these kinds of spectacles became unacceptable to the country. And you do see a decline in lynching. So I would say, in terms of the kinds of mobilization that's happening now around police brutality, that mobilization just needs to keep persisting, and there can't be a kind of defeatist attitude about that. I mean, the Black Press and the NAACP just kept at it and kept at it, and the, sort of the power of spectacle in terms of being able to mobilize people. That spectacle can operate in more than one way, and it, as much a spectacle as I argue operated to fortify and solidify white supremacy, it also operated in the service of civil rights activists, and I think that's a powerful lesson in terms of how we can look at this. But I also, as a historian, I don't think that the purpose of history is only to teach us lessons for the future, or to help us prevent things in the future. As a historian, I think what I tell my students is we study history to know who we are and where we came from, and it can help us explain why we're living in the country that we're living in. And for me, that excites me most about history. How did we get, so you can talk about your own life too. How did we get here? You have to know your own biography to understand who you are as a person. And we have to understand the history of our country to understand who we are as a country.
Appreciate that. Caller in Virginia, caller in Michigan. Did you have a question for Professor Wood? You should be with us.
Good evening. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening. I just have one quick question. Who do you think is most confused about racism, white supremacy, white people or non-white people, and why?
Who's most confused about it?
Yes.
I would say white people, I think. If I'm interpreting what you mean by confused, I think this is what I was saying in the beginning of the program. I think that white people don't really understand racism. I don't think white people really understand white supremacy. And I'm saying, as a white person, I haven't experienced it. So I can try to be, I can use empathy and use what we call empathetic imagination. I've read a lot about it. People of color, non-white people, this is something they've experienced. So they know it in a way that white people don't. I don't know if that's what you meant by confused, but that's how I would interpret what you mean.
Well, I was just wondering, who do you think is, when I say confused, meaning just understanding the system and how it works?
I don't think, and this is where Gus might disagree with me, because I think that white people, as I said, white people benefit from the system, but I don't think that I think most white people are not consciously aware of how that system works and how it benefits them. I think African Americans are much more conscious of that system and who it benefits and who it doesn't benefit. I mean, I think that the issue we were talking about in terms of police brutality is a perfect example of that. I don't think most white people were aware of how deep the problem of systematic racism in police departments was until these videos started to surface. And I would call that, if that's what you mean by, confusion or consciousness, I would point to that as an example of it.
Do you think that if white people are made aware or become more conscious of how the system works, they would stop practicing racism?
That I don't know, because white people are reluctant to give up the benefits that they gain from the system. Racism is, as I said, it's a kind of complex phenomenon, because I don't think it's as simple as, I don't like black people, or I think white people are superior. Because you won't find many white people who would say that stuff out loud, and I there's probably a lot more that maybe think it, but you have a lot of white people who wouldn't even think that way, who still benefit from racism, and they benefit from the power structures of our country. And they might say, well, no, I want, they might say on the one hand, well, I want African Americans to have full equality. But if that's going to mean that they no longer benefit from that system, then they, just look at, affirmative action would be an example of that. Right? You see many, many white people who would say, oh, I'm not racist. I don't see African Americans as being inferior, but I don't want, African Americans to be given a leg up when it comes to, say, college admissions or something like that. And so that's where these issues get really, really tricky. So I'm not sure if it's so easy as they become aware of it and then all our problems are resolved.
Okay, that's interesting. My last question is, if you can answer as best you can, what does it mean to be white? And then I'll mute my line.
What does it mean to be white? It's interesting because they talk about this sense of, people talk about whiteness as sort of a sense of invisibility, where if you're white, you have the benefit or the privilege of not having to be aware of your race. W.E.B. Du Bois begins his classic book, The Souls of Black Folk, where he talks about being asked, what does it mean to be a problem? And he talks about how, as an African-American man, he's always made aware of his race. He's always made aware of the fact that he's a problem, and it creates this sense of alienation he has with the world. And that's something that white people just don't experience. There's that part of that privilege is that your race is that you don't have to be conscious of your race. Some scholars have called it the invisibility of whiteness in that way. So I guess if I had to come up with a kind of short answer of what it means to be white, I would describe it in that way.
Okay, thanks for answering my questions. Pretty confusing, but thanks for answering it.
Sorry.
Final two callers. The caller at 6731, 6731. Did you have a question for Professor Wood? You should be with us.
Good evening, Gus, and also Professor. Actually, I kind of forgot my question. You agreed with the host earlier saying that you believe that there is a system of racism, white supremacy.
I'm sorry.
Did you agree with the host earlier at onset of the show that you do agree that there is a system of white supremacy?
Yes. Oh yes, yes.
So my question is, a system is, how could a system exist without people's participation?
I don't think it's
white people are dominating. If non-white people are not dominating, I mean, what keeps the system going on? Who perpetuates the system?
I think that people are participating in this system, so I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
I thought a few calls ago someone asked a question about that. But anyway, my second question is this. You mentioned, I know your initial text about lynching, You mentioned hidden violence. At what point did this hidden violence or lynching stop?
Well, you see, we can see the numbers decline. So the numbers are declining. You see the peak of lynching in the 1890s, and then they start to decline all the way through the 20th century. There's sort of spikes right after World War One. There's a spike right at the beginning of the Great Depression. Lynchings are declining through the 1930s. And sometimes we see sort of the last kind of public lynching. It depends how you kind of define that. But really kind of maybe 1943 during World War II. What happens after World War II is that lynchings become, I guess you'd call it underground, in the sense that you're no longer going to have big crowds. There's no longer going to be photographs taken. There's no longer going to be a kind of public advertisement, anything like that. That African Americans are still victims to violence, but they're going to be sort of small groups of men, and they kind of morph into what we would call hate crimes. And that they're not talked about. There's no kind of public recognition of this kind of violence. It's not really until, you know, Emmett Till in 1956 that you get another event that kind of makes national news and becomes a kind of public event. So that's what we mean by kind of hidden violence. It's there. It's not there to the same degree, the same level in terms of numbers of people, but it's there, and it's no longer public.
Okay, so it'd be correct to say it's pretty much it's morphed or evolved, but it still has not stopped. Would it be accurate to say that the violence is still, the terrorism still exists? It may have morphed or modified, refined itself, but it's still there.
Okay.
No further questions.
Right on. Last caller, person 0613. Did you have a question for Professor Wood?
Yes, I did. Greetings to the host. Greetings to the guests and callers and listeners. Previously, there was a professor on the program by the name, I believe, Zach Casey. Is that correct, Gus?
Yes, sir.
And he made a statement saying that to be classified as white is to be a white supremacist. Now, do you agree or disagree with that statement?
To be classified as white is to be a white supremacist. I don't know if I. I guess I would come back to what I was saying that certainly. I mean, it depends how you're defining white supremacy. If you're defining it in terms of people who benefit from the system, then I think so. But if you're talking about a kind of overt white supremacy, then no.
Second question.
Yeah.
When I've heard you use the word benefit a few times. And I would just like you to define the word benefit. And after the definition, would you say that accurately describes white people's position that we live in the world today, in the world that we live in? Does benefits accurately describe that?
Well, I guess I'm talking about white privilege. So privilege would be another way.
Well, again, with the word privilege, does privilege accurately define white people's position?
I would think that it's part of white people's position. Yeah, I mean, I don't.
That's not what I'm asking, Miss. I'm asking, does it accurately define, because we're talking about racism, people have lost their lives, continuing to lose their lives. Accurate as possible is what we're trying to do. Words and definitions
are
very important.
So I see what you mean, that privilege might seem to be not strong enough a word. Is that what you mean?
No, I'm not. I'm asking you the question.
Yeah. No, I...
Does privilege accurately define what we're talking about? Or benefits, for that matter?
I guess I'm using those in the present. So certainly...
In the present day?
I I mean, I suppose you could use another word, power. But I think privilege, I'm going to stick with privilege because I think that that's certainly, and I understand where you're coming from in terms of accurately defining it. But I think it's, I would hedge it and just qualify it and say that it's certainly part of what it means to be white in America.
Last question. Have you been completely honest with the callers and listeners on this program this evening?
Have I been completely honest? I hope so. I mean, I might have, you know, if I think about this stuff later, I might, you know, answer things differently, but I've been answering as things come into my head as honestly as I can. Do you think I haven't been?
Thank you for being on the program. And thank you for your time this evening. No
okay.
further questions.
Okay.
Right on. I will say that is one thing I appreciated about reading the book was that the term white privilege was nowhere in the book.
Yeah. Well, because I don't think it's an accurate term for that period of time at all.
I don't think it's an accurate term for any period of racism, okay. white supremacy, but that's my view. Last question I wanted to get in. You, as a white woman, a professor at Illinois State University, can you think of any times, any instances where you, as a white woman, have actually practiced white supremacy?
No. I mean, I hope not. Not that I consciously, no.
You can't think of any moment where you can ever say, hey, I think this is a moment where I was, as a white person, I was practicing white supremacy.
I can point to incidences where I have, and again, you don't like this word, where I've benefited.
Or it's not like. It's, I don't think the term is most accurate. That's very important. It's not about like yeah. with the words. It's just what I think is
yeah.
most accurate.
Yeah. But no, not that I consciously have. I feel like, you know, I feel that I'm aware of racism. I feel like I've spent a lot of time with, you know, I mean, as a professor, I have to think about these things a lot in terms of the racial dynamics in my classroom. I have to think about the racial dynamics of my classroom, teaching a diverse classroom. And so I try very hard to think through these things very carefully and to think about the experience of my African-American students and how they might be experiencing, you know, the material that we're learning. And so I try very sincerely to be sensitive to that. So I guess it would depend on how you're defining white supremacy, but I would like to think that I have not.
What percentage of your students are black?
It depends on the class. I mean, we don't have the university is about 10%. African-American, but I teach a class on slavery in the Old South where, you know, maybe a third to half of the class might be African-American. So it really depends on each class that I teach what the percentage might be.
Fascinating. Last one before we let you enjoy the rest of your Thursday evening. Has a non-white person ever accused you of practicing racism, white supremacy? Have they ever at any point said, hey, Professor Wood, I think, you know, what you just did, what you just said, I think that was an act of racism?
No. When I first started working on this project many years ago, I had both white people and African Americans question whether I should be working on this topic. And whether, as a white person, I had legitimacy or a right to work on this topic. And it was something that I talked a lot about with various people and thought a lot about. And I had other people saying the exact opposite, you know, that they valued that I would that I would write about this, and that this can't be just seen as African American history, that this is our country's history. And I guess that would be the conclusion I came to, and particularly because my book is about the African American experience, but it's also trying to understand, not to excuse by any means, but to understand white supremacy and white power and how it operated, and to do that, to understand the white mentality, to get behind us. How do people who see themselves as ordinary citizens engage in this level of violence? What does it take to get them there? So I see this as a book of American history, not a book about just Black history, African American history, and I think that too often the history of racism in this country gets relegated, it gets marginalized as African American history, and not seen as kind of central to our country's history.
So never. No one's ever, to your face, at least to your knowledge, no one's ever accused you of practicing racism, white supremacy?
No, not to my face.
Fascinating. Gain, our guest, the book that we've been talking about this evening, Lynching as Spectacle, fascinating work. Learned quite a bit reading it. One of our listeners read it some time ago, and they said that they thought it was pretty constructive. They learned quite a bit. I would have to concur. Thoroughly enjoyed the discussion. Glad you could hang out with us this Thursday evening. I guess you said the book that you're working on now, talking about crime earlier in the, I think, 20th century, I think what you said, like 1930s or
yeah.
So. I guess whenever it's out, we will, or at least I will make a heads up, see if I can track it down, if it's going to deal with racism at all, and maybe we can have you back to discuss that one as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me on. It was very, very interesting conversation.
For sure. Again, Illinois State professor, historian, author, Amy Louise Wood. Thank you again, and we will speak with you soon.
Okay. Thank you. Good night.
For sure. Evening. Context of white supremacy. Fascinating. We'll be here tomorrow. Book study session number 2, Harriet A. Washington, Medical Apartheid. If you missed the first installment, it should be in the archives. You can feel free to check it out. Looking forward. Speaking of not white privilege, another great book where the term white privilege, I suspect, I haven't read that one yet. I'm reading it first time with listeners as well. But that is another text where I do not think the term white privilege is going to appear at all, nor should it. Should not be lost on listeners, that pattern. I was even going to ask the caller. I had was kind of trying to judge. I think I've said before, I try to see if we can get our guest off, if we're going to do the full 3 hours, to have them exit somewhere around the so that we have at least 30 minutes or so left in case folks have anything important, or if I have anything important that I want to point out from the exchange in the program. I was trying to decide what was going to be my last question, if I had one at all, and I was going to bring up white privilege. So I was glad the listener brought that up, because then I didn't have to. So then I could just ask if, number one, if she has ever practiced racism, white supremacy. That is a major pattern that I think anyone, if you listen to this program and you've heard any of the white guests, litany of white guests that we've had on the program for nearly a decade now, you will find oodles of whites all over the world, male, female, older, authors, filmmaker, whatever, where they can talk for a long period of time about white privileges and white benefits and goodies that they get as a white person. All kinds of stuff. The police don't rape me. I don't get hassled. When I'm going out to shop, I can get Band-Aids that match my color. The folks at Starbucks hook me up with an extra shot of espresso. Anything that you can think of on the benefits and goodies list. Now, what have you done to practice racism? Cue the crickets. Not one thing. Doesn't matter if it's a white person that's 60 years old, 70 years old. Doesn't matter. Can't think of one thing. That right there stands out as extremely suspicious, in my opinion. As well as it, you could put that in line with the white people being ignorant about racism, white supremacy. I would submit, just because I've read her book, then we listen to her, but having read her book, she's probably a lot more informed about racism, white supremacy than, if not everybody on this call, the vast majority, I would submit. This does not seem like someone who is unfamiliar with the history of racism and its evolution in this area of the world. To me, she sounds like someone who is extremely informed about this subject matter, much more so than all of us here, I would submit. I'm sure, you know, some folks are in disagreement or what have you, but that's just this position. I think it's logical that we take that white people, you cannot maintain domination over a group of people for a long period of time and be in any way, shape, form ignorant, confused, just haphazardly going about maintaining all of this. That just does not make sense at all. At all. Anywho, Zach Casey was mentioned as well. Folks can check that out. He is an admitted racist white supremacist, but he did talk about that on the program, the impossibility of a good white person, and that to be white, that is what it has to mean if we are in a system of white supremacy, that you are a racist white supremacist. That being said, this would be another one. I would tell folks, don't buy this book. But wowee, it does have a lot of solid information. And I mean, I say that, hey, any white person, I just expect, I mean, that's just what it is. They're going to practice racism, white supremacy. That's not surprising or what have you. But because they're not ignorant, frequently they can write books, if they choose, that share, you know, a good amount of solid information about white supremacy. I would say this one, very, very interesting, just because it's not focused on lynching in the typical manner. Having it be more focused on what it means for white people watching these events, I would submit that the same applies to whites when they're watching the videos of Sandra Bland or Eric Garner. Like I said, just insert name, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, blah, 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 whoever the latest person that gets shot and killed is Walter Scott. Just insert name, that the same applies. I think the dynamics that she breaks down in the text, very, very important. That's why I tried to read quite a few different portions from the book. But again, do not purchase the book. You should be able to get this book from the library with no problem. I don't know where the person who read this book and posted it on my page and said that they too thought it was constructive information, but kudos. And I guess that would be something else I would suggest too. Feel free. If you're on my Facebook page, it does tend to have a lot of constructive information, news reports, videos, books. If you're looking for more details, feel free. Last two comments I'll get in, and then if folks have any observations that they want to share. Someone wrote me today, and I get this a lot about recommending books that people can learn about racism. And I'm almost kind of at the point of saying, I don't think there's any way you can listen to the context of white supremacy and not know about books that might be helpful for you to get a better understanding of racism. I think, number one, we've been doing a book club for 4 years. Just that book club alone, every Friday at 8 p.m., just that alone. Even if you say, well, I don't want to listen, I can't listen to audiobooks, I can't pay attention, or it's too long, or they have goofy narrators. Sometimes I have to listen to Goofy Gus reading the book, and I don't want to hear him read, or they have white narrators sometimes, or whatever. Even if you don't want to listen or participate in the book club, fine, you got better things to do with your Friday. No problem. Just look at the books that we pick for the book club. You can read them on your own. That would be one. We have an astronomical number of authors on this program, today included. Not everybody writes constructive information on racism. We have had a sizable portion of authors who have written very constructive information about racism. Unfortunately, I would have to say, today might be one. I certainly would again say, do not purchase the books that white people have written. But man, we have had a ton of black authors, white authors, non-white authors on the program. It just maybe some of the people are new listeners. I generally do try to give a few suggestions out for books that I would recommend. I know we had Dr. Welsing on the program over the years. I would ask her about books to read. She would normally give two or three different offerings or different books that she saw going to the bookstore or people gave to her or what have you that she would recommend. That's been something just going back and listening to the archives since her transition earlier this year. I've heard at least three, four, five different books that she talked about and recommended, some that I had forgotten about that I wanted to read, some that I was like, hey, we're going to do this for the book club later this year. But I mean, there is no way you can listen to the cows and be clueless about possible books to check out to get more information about racism, white supremacy. Again, if you need a starter, the book club is tomorrow, Medical Apartheid. That would certainly be one I would recommend if you want to get more information about racism, white supremacy. Last thing I'll get in and then we'll check, see if callers have anything they would like to share. Just the Harriet Tubman. I mentioned this before, but I think it is important now just because I've heard it in the last, I guess, week or so. Some people have been talking about the general, Harriet Tubman. People reference, I guess, the piece of folklore and saying that she had her firearm and would tell enslaved black people, you know, hey, this is what it is. We're going to leave. These whites are going to be trying to kill us. This is serious. We get out here, you're going to have to, you know, follow directions. We got to do what we got to do to be safe. If they catch us, they could kill us, maim us, rape us, anything. Got to be safe. And if you're, you know, act up or decide that you don't want to do it, get scared, decide you want to run back or anything, got my gun, I might have to use it on you. I've heard that in the last week since they've been talking about her being placed on the $20 bill. And I've heard that for years now. When people mention Harriet Tubman, I spoke with Mr. Fuller some years ago. I would encourage anybody, if you call Mr. Fuller or if you, you know, hear him on a broadcast or what have you, Talktainment, wherever, and you get an opportunity, you should ask him to give you his view on this. Man. And he just brought it up casually. We were talking about something else, and he just brought it up and said, I think that racists made that up. And I said, well, dang, why do you take that position, Mr. Fuller? Because I don't think at the time I'd heard anybody say this. And he said, okay, I'm just using logic. Follow the logic. He says, number one, what type of gun do you think Harriet Tubman had? Now, I've seen photographs where people, you know, say this is Harriet Tubman, she's got her gun. We've had guests on the program who talked that they've been able to hold a gun. This is the 1800s. They had laws where if you were a black person, you couldn't even purchase a firearm. That's one. What type of firearm do you think she would have had? It's not like she would have had a Glock. It's not like she would have had a 9mm. I mean, you know, 1800s firearm, not like she's going to have an efficient killing machine at the ready. And how many bullets exactly do you think she's going to have? Again, they didn't even sell firearms to black people. They had laws against selling firearms to black people in many locales during the 1800s. So exactly how many bullets do you think she would have had? How well do you think this gun would have worked? How accurate do you think this gun would have been? And then she's quoted, Harriet Tubman, I could have freed many more slaves if they had known they were slaves. If you had a significant population of black people who were confused about their status or ambivalent, hesitant about leaving, to me, it just, again, following the logic, Mr. Fuller said, it just doesn't seem logical to me that this is going to be some sort of coercion and I'm grabbing somebody by the ear and pulling them off the plantation. That just does not seem logical with everything that General Tubman would have been facing. They've got a bounty on her. Whites are looking to kill her. I mean, slaves are expensive. You're stealing property that could be worth $1,000, $1,500 in $1,800. I mean, woo! This is major theft of racist property, stealing these black bodies, literally. This is serious business. We could all be killed, mutilated, raped, anything could happen. This cannot be something where you're just forcing people off at gunpoint and making them go. Then he also said, so, okay, if she has a group of slaves that she's taking, trying to liberate them, it's three, four, five different black people. And one person says, hey, I'm scared, man. I hear the dogs. These white folks are crazy. I'm just going to go back and behave, do my work. And, you know, I'm done with all this. If they decide that they're going to up and run, like, again, now, how accurate do you think the shooting is going to be where she's going to be able to pick this person off? And again, they're under heavy duress. Unless I've been misinformed, firing a gun makes a lot of noise that could draw attention to, hey, I heard a gunshot. What was that? Maybe just, you know, inquire people to think that. I think that was his whole point in kind of giving his view and saying that I think racists slipped that in. He also added that it tends to be a major part of white supremacy. There's always got to be a reason to beat, shoot, maim a black person. Just got to be. They won't do right. Niggas just, you know, they're lazy. They're childlike. They're impudent. They need a good beating. You got to get them in line. You can hardly get anything useful out of them at all unless you give them, you know, 9-20 hits with the lash. You just got to. I mean, that's standard racist logic. I even hear that from a lot of victims of racism, that that's what we need to do to get more black people focused and serious about solving this problem. They need a good whipping. We need to just get the lashes back out and go upside a couple of these folks' head and get them to think straight. That seems to be a consistent bit of racist rhetoric that he thinks Mr. Fuller has just been fused into the lore of Harriet Tubman, that she was shooting or threatening to shoot black people to get them off of the plantation. I was reminded and made sure I said I wanted to share that again on the program because I've heard that more and glowingly. Generally, when I hear it, it's something of pride, like, yeah, she had her gun and she was going to make them do right. And I'm just suspicious of anything that is sounding like a part of what needs to be done in solving this problem is further threatening black people, who are the most threatened, intimidated, terrorized people on the planet. I'm suspicious of anything that is sounding like we need to replicate that in order to solve the problem. Just something to think about. I think that was how Mr. Fuller ended his whole commentary on that he thinks racists have lied, have added that. He said he started hearing it recently. And when he said recently, he meant like within the last 20, 30 years or so that he started hearing that more prominently. And it just doesn't seem logical. That was the thing he said more frequently than anything. It just doesn't seem logical for the time period and everything that she would have been facing under those harrowing circumstances. It does not seem logical. I will pause there. If folks have anything they would like to share, add in before we wrap things up. We have about 10 minutes. Folks who dialed in line should be open. If you have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Gus, you had me split my side with what you were saying just now, and I remember you talking about this, this split nearly Fuller, and it makes perfect sense, and it just kind of seems like the Willie Lynch letter. They always have to infuse some sort of anti-blackness into anything, so even in the situation where you're trying to liberate yourself, you know, there has to be some anti-blackness in there somewhere. I agree. The logic makes perfect sense, and it was hilarious. Speaking to tonight's caller, she seemed to be a highly refined racist. And when I say highly refined, I'll just go back to the question that I asked about black people suffering from PTSD, watching these videos over and over, and white people being anesthetized to black violence. She could answer the white question without a problem, but then she said she didn't feel that she was qualified to answer the question about black people suffering from PTSD. And, I mean, you don't need a degree. You know, none of us are doctors, but you can watch 1,000 documentaries about Vietnam veterans coming back from war suffering from PTSD, or news clips or documentaries about Chicago and the fact that those young black children are suffering from PTSD. So, I mean, it doesn't take anything but some common sense and looking at the consistent trauma of black people that remains unaddressed, and just the numerous amount of videos of us getting shot to death just about every week, and the fact that we would wholesale be suffering from something like that because the vast majority of us watch the news on a regular basis, whether it's just to be aware of what's happening, even if it's for the weather, just to wake up the next day, you're going to have to, you know what the weather is. You're still going to get some aspect of the news just waiting for the weather to come on. So we see these things all the time, and it has an effect. And I just felt that she did it in such a sly way that it would have gone over someone's head, but I didn't want to go back and forth with her. I like what some of the other callers' questions, and I just didn't want to go back and forth with her because I realized just how refined she is. But she's highly refined and highly skillful at dodging questions in a seemingly demure kind of a manner. And I'll mute my line there. Thanks for taking my call, guys.
For sure. That's another big pattern, too, where white people, if you ask them a question commenting on black people, is, oh, man, I don't feel comfortable, you know, commenting about black. I'm a white person. You know, I'm just kind of fumbling through this myself, and I just don't feel comfortable speaking to black people's issues or advising black people about what they
I could do. I'm just, you know, a dumb, ignorant white person myself. So, you know, you'll have to get somebody black to answer. That's pretty good. I think that has been demonstrated on this program quite a few times over the years, and people have asked a similar type of question to a white person to comment on how black people are impacted or responding to white terrorism.
It's a subtle way of distancing yourself from the victim without seeming to come across in the so-called non-politically correct way. Just to use that phraseology, because that's the only thing I could think of that would kind of equate to it. But it's a way of distancing yourself from the your quarry, which is us, we're the prey, but doing it in a way that's seemingly non-offensive. Maybe I could put it that way, non-offensive. But that's what it is, because it's just common sense. If you have any connection to any other living thing besides your narcissistic white supremacist self, you can look at another living thing suffering and understand what that suffering is on some level, whether or not you've gone through it yourself. So that just goes to show that psychopathic, sociopathic, narcissistic disconnect, but it manifests itself in that subtle way.
Can I be heard?
Yes.
So, good evening again, Thomas Smith, New York. Good evening, Roz. Good evening, Gus, all the callers. And the last caller asked some very good questions. And, you know, like Roz just said, she was very refined. You know, she comes from the capital of white liberalism over there in Chicago. So it doesn't surprise me. I was hoping Gus asked her for access to the library like he asked the last professor. See if she was going to be willing to give up some access to the online archives. I'm sure Illinois State has a extensive archive of material. I think that the way she wrote the book, or the way that the passages that Gus read, and the way she answered the question, even though she was, you know, pretty much, you know, telling what happened, she was also making excuses for the white people at the time in the same breath. You know, well, they did it because of this, or, you know, kind of sort of rationalizing their thought process behind it. And, yeah, she didn't seem to want to answer a lot of questions. She came up with that phrase that you guys just said, where she was, you know, she's not qualified, but you're a college professor at a major institution. I mean, I would think that you're qualified to answer questions like, what percentage of white people do you think would have a, let me just give a guess. I mean, I think that you're definitely qualified to give that. Last thing, you know, from what you said about Harriet Tubman, she was trying to free the slaves, and, you know, some of them didn't know they were slaves. First, I would say the logic was excellent. And you know, that's sort of like today, if you try to tell someone it's a system of racism, white supremacy, and they're trying to fight it, man, you crazy, you ain't no system, you know, it seems like things haven't changed too much. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Right. They need a good beating. That's all it is. That'll solve the problem. Get you a good switch, that'll solve it. Anybody else? Comments they want to make sure they got in before we wrap things up? Folks who had a hand up.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. The logic of, from the sound, he's always sound. I mean, he's got great questions and he's got going on in his head there. I like listening to him ask this question. And I pretty much came up with that as the same type of questions before about Harriet Tubman, but then I had to when I read stuff and when I hear what my grandparents tell me, there's some contradictions. They're saying, hey, they had weapons. they might not have been the greatest of weapons, but they had some. You know, they hunted with stuff. They had things, and then you read about wars like the Yamasee and other wars over the Seminole Wars and the Negro Wars in the Southeast. They had weapons. They got them from the French or wherever they got them from, they got weapons.
So the black people had weapons. But the logic is that if you're going to make noise trying to shoot somebody, you know, and get away from, you know, just giving away her position. That right there, that's the military mind of Muley Fuller thinking. You don't want to give away your position if you try to sneak around. You see, that's logical. And, yeah, I thought that was some incredible story myself. And it just doesn't make sense. But I do believe she had a weapon. And I think as soon as black folks got free, if they had the money to get one, they got one. And I believe that some black folks that were not ever enslaved had weapons. They made sure they had one or got one. But I do believe that black people did have weapons. Also, about the guests here, I just find it strange that everybody we bring on, they can never tell me where or how the idea of white got into these people's head and how they implemented it, where they go to talk about it, how they get all on the same board together, you know, and start just, you know, like a football team. You know, you go to the room, you draw up the plays, this is how we're going to run this sweep, we're going through the alley, blah, 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 and you come out in the field and you decept everybody around the field, you deceive everybody to get into the end zone. How'd you do it? Who was the first one to come up with it? Blah, blah, blah. You're a history professor. You should be able to tell me that right on off the bat. You know, oh, it was Ben Tillman. But no. But I'm in my line.
Mine on. No, the people listening online, I got disconnected, had some sort of interference with the line. Could be just whites doing their thing. But the archive will be pristine. Folks, you've only missed a few seconds. Everybody satisfied? Folks who had commentary, getting in everything they wanted to say? Right on. I think Mr. Fuller, he also added, part of the human experience is that you do get tired. You do have to go to sleep, even if it's just for a small period of time. If you really, really did not want to continue with all of, you know, Harriet Tubman's foolishness and, you know, forget it. I'm going to just go back and behave and listen to these white people. You just wait till she went to sleep and then make your run. Logical. Just follow the logic. Anywho, again, we should be back tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Harriet Washington, Medical Apartheid. Great book. Again, looking forward to continuing. Tune in. Second installment, we just started, but I think we're still liking the first section. We haven't got very far at all, so tune in. I think you will learn a lot. And again, for folks, you know, if you're about books, just scroll through the archives. I guarantee you will find lots and lots of books to get constructive information. Just based on the sections, before we wrap up, the sections read, I'm not so much talking about her performance in terms of answering questions and what have you, but from the sections that were read from the book, did that seem like constructive or accurate information in talking about racism, white supremacy, the sections that you all heard from the text, the people that I heard that and are on the line?
I think it was constructive, but at the same time, I think she was scapegoating for white people at the time, kind of sort of trying to rationalize their terrorism. But I think it was definitely constructive information. In fact, I think white people put out very constructive information about racism and white supremacy. They're the experts.
I would agree. I think she was actually more honest in the book than she was on the show. I think on the program she was refined, one of the most refined racist white supremacists I've heard. She has an excellent way of dodging, and she uses the tone of her voice to think she's getting away with stuff. Like I said, I just didn't feel like going back and forth with her, but I would say she's highly refined. The book, the sections you read, I would say are very constructive. Her performance on the program, when the brother asked her, do you think you're being completely honest with us, or would you say you're being completely honest with us? Perfect question. Perfect question, because I could just tell from the questions I asked and how she answered them, and then just listening to the other people who she tried to skillfully dodge their questions as well. Yeah, it was something else. She's a trip.
Right on. If I remember the person's name, I would give them credit. And this is like from a while back. I to like give full context to how I even got this book. I was trying to find an article from the Seattle Times from this is like the end of 2014. And this is on the front page of the Seattle Times, where they were talking about how bad things are for black people in Seattle, and they had all these statistics, and it's getting better for everybody in Seattle except black people. And I was trying to go back to find this article to put it back in my bookmarks, and so I had to go through my Facebook page because I knew I had shared it there. So I'm going back and just scrolling through all the different posts and what have you, and that post about Professor Wood's book was one that I read before I got to that link. And the black person was saying, hey, this is a constructed book. I just read good information. And I'm not even sure if they recommended having her as a guest or if they just were like, yeah, you all should check this out. It's pretty interesting. But I would have to co-sign. Very, very interesting book. And again, just because I have not really heard people commenting in depth about all of these white people watching and what does that mean in the system of white supremacy. And again, I would say it applies directly to what you're seeing today with all these videos, the snuff flicks that we've been talking about for the past few years. I would even include what's happening at the Donald Trump rallies with black people being mauled and molested there. Certainly the Purge and other forms of racist entertainment, racist cinema. I would just add all of that in there. It serves the exact same functioning, where white people get that same sort of experience with appreciating, devouring black death, necrophilia, same exact thing. But hopefully folks got some constructive details. Always good to ask questions of white folks. With that.
Hey Gus, why did you ask her for access to the college archive?
I thought about that, and if it had not taken so much time with the book, I probably would have. But I did think about that at the end of the program. I was kind of looking at time because I knew there were a few things that I wanted to talk about, and I did want to ask her if she had practiced racism. Like that was kind of if I was only going to ask one more question before I let her go, that was the one that I wanted to ask. But I definitely had that in mind. Not that I'd never even heard of Illinois State University. If it had been maybe a institution that I thought was a bit more prestigious, I suspect I probably would have made time to ask that one. But I'd never even heard of Illinois State University. But yeah, maybe
they got a basketball team and stuff. They're not as big as the University of Illinois, but yeah, I would say a sizable university.
That might have messed up. Maybe she would have been the cool white person to hook me up, so I could have got access to their archives. I have to do that, put that on the list. The next white person that we get on the program that's affiliated with any institute, to just ask, regardless of whether it's a big name school or not, to just ask, just to see how they respond, if nothing else. But yeah, that will be one for the road. Hopefully we'll have opportunities to get some more white folks for the month of May. With that, we'll be back in about 24 hours. If folks have other questions, gripes, guest suggestions, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. I guess you can get us on Twitter. Twitter as well, @untiljustice. Facebook, facebook.com/theproblemiswhitepeople. White people. I will say, if it's a guest suggestion, I would encourage you to email it. That would be much better. I have folders in my email account for guest suggestions. That way I don't lose them. I can just go back and reference. It doesn't matter when you sent it. It'll just be there. I'll know where it is. And I just check the folder as we have space on the calendar. Then I can just go and email and ask. Sometimes it does take months. Sometimes it takes years to get people on the program. But I do go back and review those. It's much easier. If you send it on Facebook, it can be much more challenging to go back in the timeline or try to remember who the person was who made the suggestion on Facebook to track it down. That way it could just be a lot more difficult for me. So if it's a guest suggestion, probably be best if you send it as an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Looking at these lynching photographs and what, just for that alone, this book, because there are a lot of photographs of different lynchings that I had never even seen before. And she also even talks about the difference why you, I've never seen a photograph of a black person being lynched nude, whereas they lynched some white people and they did show them nude, and talking about the difference in why that was and what was acceptable imaging and what have you. Just the photographs alone, as I said, the image that she has on the front, it's terrifying to see this one little black person in an ocean of whites, white women, white men, white children. It is just wow. Just for the images alone, even if you don't read the text, it is something to check out. But man, it really emphasizes we are in an extremely dangerous predicament. Whether it's any time under the system of white supremacy, you just never know when you'll have to deal with white people. They are extremely dangerous, and that's something that we just cannot minimize or take for granted. We really need to be in a state of alert and just realizing that war is being waged against us 24/7. We just can't afford to be out not thinking clearly, intoxicated, where you're just not alert and paying attention to your surroundings and things that are happening around you. Definitely, if you're going to be in a vehicle, you do not want to be driver, passenger, even pedestrian. You do not want to be inebriated where Daniel Holtzclaw, Daniel Pantaleo, any other race soldier, they happen to be the one that pulls up behind you, stops you, and you can't think clearly. You can't respond clearly. You're just making their job easy to terrorize you and even take your life. You, anybody else that you might be with or responsible for, just keep that in mind. And again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. And buckle up if you're going to be in a vehicle. Let's just do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers and white people, period. Badge or no, they are dangerous. That being said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow, signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.